You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And I think that there's been a lot of analysis with regard to Iran, to the extent that the Syrian war, in a sense, is part of the roadmap. As some analysts have underscored, the road to Tehran goes through Damascus. And consequently, the outcome of the Syrian war is crucial in defining the next stage of this broader Middle East agenda.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, Global Warfare. Is the U.S. NATO going to attack Russia? Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and The New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we discuss the significance of NATO's large-scale military exercises underway in Eastern Europe. Global warfare and non-conventional warfare, Iran and the Middle East, the Odad-Yinon plan, and the strategic alliance between Russia and China within a larger global geopolitical framework. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on the program.
You have talked about Anaconda 2016, NATO's large-scale military exercises underway in Poland. The war games, launched on Monday, June 6th, will run until June 17th. How significant are these war games?
Well, they're certainly significant, but they shouldn't be interpreted as war preparations against the Russian Federation. They're there to threaten Russia, but in fact, we must understand that we're in the framework of global warfare. And by threatening Russia on its western frontier with the European Union, doesn't signify necessarily that NATO and, of course, the United States are intent upon attacking Russia using conventional military hardware. And there are many reasons for that. First of all, Russia is involved in the Middle East. The United States and its allies are threatening Russia, China, and Iran. The United States and its allies are involved in a war in the Middle East in which, of course, Iran and Russia are involved, directly involved. I'm talking about Syria. So that by putting pressure on Russia in Eastern Europe, the United States is also, in effect, manipulating the environment, the geopolitical environment. I should mention, and that's very important, that history tells us that war is based on deceit and intelligence. And you don't amass significant weapon systems on the border with a historical enemy, namely the Russian Federation, and then send out press releases of what you're doing. Okay? So that if we compare this particular exercise to World War II and Operation Barbarossa, which was launched on the 22nd of June 1941, well, in fact, this was a secret operation. It was decided upon on December 10th, 1940, at a time when the relations between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany were, in fact, normal and in fact quite good, that the Nazi government had in fact approached Russia and asked them if they wanted to have some kind of relationship to the Axis powers. That was subsequently abandoned, but there was trade, there was diplomatic relations between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, and of course that dated back to the non-aggression pact signed in 1938 between Molotov and Ribbentrop. And so that if we look at history, first of all, deception is ultimately the guiding light. You deceive your enemy, and you do not reveal your war plans. Although, in fact, the war plans are known because there's intelligence, and the Russians have intelligence, the Americans have intelligence. And with regard to Operation Barbarossa, there was intelligence that the Axis powers, well, namely Nazi Germany, was preparing a massive invasion. But somehow Stalin did not take it seriously. It was communicated to him, and he didn't take it seriously. And then Germany started deploying massive amounts of military hardware on Russia's border, starting in May, and then the campaign was launched on the 22nd of June. But what I think is significant with regard to these war games on Russia's doorstep is that they coincide with the 75th anniversary of Operation Barbarossa. They started in early June, and they are to be completed somewhere towards the 18th of June. And then in early July, there's going to be a major NATO conference which will underscore strategic alliances as well as war plans in relation to the Russian Federation. But bear in mind, we're in a different era. It is very unlikely that a war with Russia would involve an onslaught of conventional warfare with tanks and armored cars, as occurred, let's say, in previous wars. So we're not talking about a conventional war theater per se. And in all likelihood, if such a war were to be launched, it would involve non-conventional weapon systems, including the paralysis, let's say, of communication systems. It would include financial warfare, the freezing of financial transactions and trade. And there are many other advanced weapon systems, such as climatic warfare, the engineering, the geoengineering, which are fully operational and which could be used. So what I'm saying here is that in this particular era, it's these non-conventional endeavors which are being implemented, and some of them may involve the deployment of conventional forces in some cases. In other cases, it's special forces, it's the war on terrorism, it's the financing of insurgencies, it's the manipulation of commodity and financial markets. We saw it in relation to the oil market, how that collapsed was ultimately conducive to the destabilization of several oil-producing economies, such as Venezuela. And very often, these various non-conventional mechanisms are combined with regime change, the financing of protest movements, and so on and so forth. So in a very different environment, but we are within the environment of global warfare. And this is part of a military agenda which is certainly formulated. And in fact, World War III has been formulated by the Pentagon for years now. Every year they have war games which have as a paradigm World War III. Some of the scenarios actually have been made public, others not. Most of them are secret undertakings if we're talking about military planning. But we know, for instance, that the Pentagon is simulating essentially a global military agenda directed against four countries at this stage. Russian Federation, the People's Republic of China, Iran, and North Korea. Those four countries are identified, and they're identified in war games. I recall, for instance, what was called, well, it was a war game which involved four fictitious countries, and it was made public. It's a Pentagon project: Churia, Rubek, Nemesi, and Ermingham. Okay, so Churia, China, Rubek, Russia, Ermingham, Iran, and Nemesi, North Korea. And there were other such war games. Now, I think what is very important that people must understand that is that World War III is an option. It is an option. And the use of nuclear weapons on a preemptive basis is also an option. And in other words, we're dealing with military assumptions which potentially could lead humanity to complete destruction. It's not to say that this would take place immediately, but if there is a nuclear war, this spells a worldwide catastrophe. And nuclear weapons are on the table. Hillary Clinton has said that she wants to use them, and she wants to use them against Iran. Now, to summarize, if we're looking at a chronology of what's going to happen, I think that the next step in this military agenda is not Russia, but it is Iran. And it would involve, of course, America's various allies in the Middle East. Of course, NATO is involved, but here we have major actors: Israel, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. And in effect, if we look at the Syrian war theater, we see that these various actors are already there. Iran is assisting the Syrian government forces, and so is Russia. And Turkey and Saudi Arabia are assisting the terrorists in liaison with the United States. So that, from my understanding, we might say that World War III has already commenced. But as far as the roadmap, the World War III roadmap is concerned, I think that the next stage is Iran. And notice that the United States is not actually threatening Iran at this particular juncture. Well, one can't say at the same time that there's been normalization since the agreement on nuclear energy. But if we're looking at where the threats are most visible from the propaganda point of view, it's in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states. And what I'm saying essentially is that the deployment of this massive deployment of military hardware is not there for military purposes. It's there for propaganda purposes. It's there to intimidate, and it's also there to intimidate the Russian people. But the Russian military planners are not so stupid. They know that when a war is being planned, it's usually a secret operation. And they also have their own intelligence services, which are indicating to them as to what the next step of this war is going to be. And the next step of this war is in the Middle East and not in Western Europe.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Global Warfare. Is the U.S. NATO going to attack Russia? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Well, Michel, you have just pointed out that history tells us that war plans are based on deceit, but that in the case of Anaconda 2016, these deployments in Eastern Europe and the Baltics are public, and that their main goal is to, quote, essentially to give leeway to the United States to wage its wars in other regions of the world, particularly in the Middle East. How large are these military drills in Poland?
Now, we're talking about very substantial deployments of military hardware with a large number of countries which are participating in these war games. And from that point of view, it's symbolic. But in effect, this is being deployed is essentially to intimidate. And it doesn't signify that this is going to result in an actual confrontation with the Russian Federation, which from the point of view of NATO would be absolute suicide, because the Russian Federation's conventional forces are very advanced, and so are their strategic capabilities. So they're not really going to, unless somebody makes some stupid mistake. And I should mention that mistakes are often the cause of war, okay? We don't necessarily, it's not necessarily logistics and geopolitics and so on. We're dealing with a military planning process which is very sophisticated, which is very intricate in terms of networks. We have to look at U.S. Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska, which coordinates, and then you have the command structures, then you have your allies, then you have your air defense system. Israel's air defense system is integrated into that of the United States and NATO. There's a very structured decision-making process with many different actors. But it is also under those circumstances that errors occur. And some of the errors will occur because the decision makers believe their own propaganda. And I'll give you an example. For instance, now the U.S. Senate in 2002, so it goes back. It's a post-9/11 decision when Rumsfeld was, you know, Secretary of Defense, that at that time, and it's not known to the public, is that nuclear weapons were reclassified and they can be used in the conventional war theater without the green light from the commander-in-chief, namely the President of the United States. And this applies to a category of nuclear weapons which are called mini-nukes, but they have an explosive capacity between one-third and six times the Hiroshima bomb. They're deployed pretty much, well, they're deployed in Western Europe. Turkey has them. Several allies of the United States who are non-nuclear states have them, and they're deployed against Iran, but also against the Russian Federation, and they can be used on a preemptive basis, in other words, for self-defense, without approval at the highest level of government. And they are categorized as harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground, so to speak. And this is now written up in the military manuals. So a three-star general in let's say, Central Command in the Middle East is going to follow the military manual. And he says, oh, the Bunker Buster B-61-12 tactical nuclear weapon is harmless to civilians, let's go ahead and use it. And so what I'm saying is people believe their propaganda, and particularly people like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump believe their own propaganda. Hillary Clinton has made the statement that nuclear weapons are on the table, and she has intimated that Iran would be obliterated. I'm using the same words as Hillary Clinton. And so mistakes combined with stupidity, paranoia, and ignorance. There are two types of mistakes. There are those which are dependent on technical or logistical errors, namely a nuclear weapon might be sent off by mistake due to some technical weaknesses, and there have been many cases of this nearly happening. which have been amply documented. But there are other types of mistakes, so-called mistakes, which have to do with paranoia, political paranoia, and stupidity and ignorance of officials in high office. And that we have to be very careful. Can we trust somebody like Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump to make seasoned and wise decisions on behalf of not only on behalf of the United States, but on behalf of the world, because we're talking about World War III? And I'd say from their statements, I'd say we have to be very careful. These people are very dangerous. They shouldn't be. They should not accede to the highest office of the land, namely presidency of the United States of America.
Michel, according to your analysis, the next phase of this global war is Iran and the Middle East, not Russia, and that the buildup in Europe serves that purpose. What is the evidence for that?
Well, the evidence is really very much based on statements and war plans and timelines which have been released by the Pentagon. We can refer to Wesley Clark's, famous statements of seven countries in 5 years, where he lists, well, it's based on testimony from a Pentagon official, where he actually says it's seven countries in 5 years, and these are the countries. Now, I can tell you that that back in the 90s already, Central Command Headquarters had identified, and that was well before the Iraq War, okay? Back in the mid-90s, well, the Gulf War had already been implemented in 91. But what the Central Command document says is textually, first Iraq, then Iran. And the rationale was to ensure unimpeded access to Middle East oil. So it's part of the battle for oil. And it's also part of a battle to prevent competing powers from having alliances in the Middle East with countries like Iraq and Iran. Okay? And so it really is the hegemony of the Anglo-American oil companies, which is sought. Now, to get back to General Wesley Clark, who is currently a retired four-star army general, who was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO during the 1999 war on Yugoslavia. Well, in what he says, and he's quoting a Pentagon official with whom he had a conversation when he was, I think he was still serving. This goes back to a statement made in 2007, and the quote is, "We're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with Iran." Now, we can see that several of those countries have already been invaded, including, of course, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia. Well, in fact, all of them except Iran, okay? So if we go by the testimony of General Wesley Clark, the next country which has not been attacked by the United States and its allies is Iran. All the others have, in one form or another. And, of course, we still have Yemen, which is not in the list. But we now have an extended war theater in the Middle East. We started up with Iraq, and of course we had Afghanistan, which is pretty much sort of at the other end. It's not really part of the Middle East from a geopolitical point of view, but it's Central Asia. So Central Asia and the Middle East is the broader region. And what we have seen since the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, both the earlier as well as the subsequent attacks in 2001, okay, is a roadmap which has led to escalation. Afghanistan in 2001, Iraq in 2003, and then of course Syria and Libya in 2011, and then you have Yemen, and then of course you also have the drone attacks in Pakistan, which it's not a declared war, but it's still a war against a sovereign nation. It's attacks, drone attacks within Pakistan's territory, and it's an act of aggression. And so that ultimately what is building up is military escalation extending from the Eastern Mediterranean and the Maghreb, okay, all the way through to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And bear in mind that Afghanistan has a border with China. So we're extending this war, this regional war, right to the western frontier of the People's Republic of China. And I should also mention that in China, in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, there are Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups which are supported covertly by Pakistani intelligence in liaison with the CIA. So that is the perspective. And I think that there's been a lot of analysis with regard to Iran, to the extent that the Syrian war, in a sense, is part of the roadmap, as some analysts have underscored. The road to Tehran goes through Damascus, and consequently, the outcome of the Syrian war is crucial in defining the next stage of this broader Middle East agenda, which essentially consists in breaking up countries, establishing spheres of influence, transforming countries into territories. It's not necessarily to win the war militarily, but you destroy Libya, you destroy Iraq, you undermine the institutions, and you create territories. And these territories, of course, have tremendous resources, particularly in oil. And then you wage a demonization campaign against the Muslims, and it just so happens that Muslim countries have approximately between 60 and 70% of the world's reserves of crude oil. I'm not talking about other forms of oil, such as tar sands. And if those countries had been inhabited by Buddhists, we would be demonizing the Buddhists. But we are now demonizing the inhabitants of the countries that we want to conquer, which have tremendous resources in terms of oil. And then, of course, there are other actions taken in sub-Saharan Africa against Nigeria, for instance, with Boko Haram. Boko Haram is known to be an intelligence asset as well, linked up to the Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations, which are CIA-sponsored. So that is the nature of the broader war. It's the extension of this military agenda within the Middle East, the breakup of countries, the establishment of new borders. It's what some U.S. military analysts call the new Middle East.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Global Warfare, is the U.S. NATO going to attack Russia? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You've mentioned oil as an objective of these Middle Eastern wars, but what is the overall objective of all of these wars in the Middle East? Is it part of the Oded Yinon plan for Greater Israel?
Well, you know, I think the Greater Israel plan can be used by the United States and NATO as an instrument of conquest. I think from my standpoint, Israel is not a partner in the same way as the other Western powers are partners with the United States. Okay, it's a small country. It has certainly very important capabilities, and it's very much dependent on U.S. military aid. But it serves a geopolitical purpose in the Middle East, in the pursuit of let's say, the pursuit of conquest in the Middle East. Israel is absolutely, of course, essential. Okay? And I recall that going back to 2000, I can't recall, it was at least 10 years ago, it was during the Bush administration, Dick Cheney intimated that Israel might do the work for us. And he was talking about the bombing of Iran. And I think that's still the case, that Israel would be an instrument on behalf of the United States and NATO. In other words, we see this pattern of the United States using its allies to do the dirty work. Well, Israel would do the dirty work, and in exchange for that, they would get Greater Israel, or at least they'd be able to expand their territory. And certainly, the policies of the Netanyahu government are, in fact, geared towards that. It's ultimately the appropriation of Palestinian lands, the ultimate policy of genocide and exodus of the Palestinians from their homeland. That is part of it, and it's being used as a mechanism to incite this broadening of the Middle East conflict, so that you have Israel. And you have Turkey and Saudi Arabia. I think these are the three countries which are starting to play a major role in the Middle East war. And I should mention that they also have very important bilateral relations. Turkey and Israel have an agreement which goes back some 20, 30 years. It goes back to the 90s. Namely, it's a relationship of cooperation in military and intelligence, in defense production, in intelligence, very close bilateral relation. And there may be ups and downs in that relationship, but it is still standing. And Israel is also building bilateral relations with Saudi Arabia. So these countries are going to be used. And I should mention that both Turkey and Israel have territorial, they have certain plans to extend their territory. We see it with Turkey at this very moment. Their plan is to annex a portion in other words, the northern part of Syria. And similarly, Israel wants to extend its territory, so that these partners are playing a key role, but ultimately they are subordinate to the Pentagon. They don't call the shots. They don't call the shots. They may call the shots in some regards, but broadly, from a broad military planning point of view, they are integrated within U.S. Pentagon and NATO decision-making processes. And I should say that NATO is dominated by the United States. So that I think that's the background. It's not to say that the plan of Greater Israel is the objective of this war. But it is, in fact, it's a byproduct of this war, and it is very useful for the Western military alliance to use it with a view to reaching its broader objective, which is to recolonize, so to speak, the Middle East and Central Asian region. And once Iran, at least from the point of view of military planners, I'm not suggesting it's going to happen, but once Iran implements some form of regime change and succumbs to the powers of NATO and the United States, this changes the geopolitical balance. Because as I mentioned, there are four countries which are identified, and they're also identified in military and in war game scenarios, which are considered to be on the target list. And those are Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. And I think the other dimension, which is absolutely crucial, is that the structure of military alliances is also an instrument of conquest. We've seen it in all previous major world conflicts. In World War One, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente, the shift in the structure of alliances was ultimately decisive in the onslaught of World War One, and similarly in World War Two, the alliances of the Axis with Italy and also subsequently with Japan. But in this particular context, in the context of global warfare, the major thrust of the United States has been to weaken the strategic relationship between Russia and China. And they've been doing that for quite some time. The signing of the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement in 1972 was Kissinger and of course Richard Nixon who negotiated that. The restoration of capitalism in China, Deng Xiaoping, which was ultimately serving U.S. interests and who was very much anti-Soviet at the time, that was sort of bring China into the orbit of the Western military alliance. And of course, China is integrated as an industrial colony into serving, you know, into producing made in China. It's the biggest, the United States is the biggest market for China. So there's a cross-cutting alliance there. China is allied with Russia, but at the same time, China has extensive trade agreements with the United States. It has a bilateral agreement that is signed in 2001, which was prior to its entry into the World Trade Organization, which allows for U.S. banks and Western banks to enter into the Chinese financial landscape. And so they're all there, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, Citigroup, they all have their subsidiaries there. They even have access to domestic banking, which was provided to them. And in that regard, we can't simply say that China is a firm ally of the Russian Federation. It may be at a certain level in military and strategic affairs, but from an economic standpoint, we cannot ignore the fact that the United States has very close bilateral relations with the People's Republic of China.
You have said that the U.S. wants to break the strategic alliance between Russia and China by co-opting China. How, in your opinion, does the U.S. propose to achieve breaking this alliance?
Well, I'm not clear as to whether the United States is undertaking this in the right way, because in effect, in recent years, they have been threatening China with regard to its territorial waters. The relationship is quite aggressive, at least from the military strategic point of view. But as I mentioned, the economic relations are relatively good, and there are people within the leadership which are very pro-American. And I've experienced this on recent trips to China when I I addressed the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, and I pointed out the fact that China's borders were surrounded with U.S. military facilities and that they were being threatened. But that was a couple of years back. And the reaction was rather negative. They said, well, no, we have good relations with the United States. And they essentially accused me. They took the side of the United States and said, Professor, you have given us a left-leaning perspective. But that's just to indicate that people in government and people in the universities and the think tanks in China tend to be pro-American. And on the other hand, people in the military are, on the whole, anti-American. So there's a situation which I would describe as, well, it's contradictory, but you have cross-cutting alliances. And on the one hand, Russia and China have a strategic alliance under the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. On the other hand, the United States has trade and investment alliance with China, which is extensive due to the volume of that trade. And bear in mind, another important factor is that these countries are now capitalist countries. So, they're not upholding an alternative economic system as in the heyday of the Cold War. Okay? There's no more so-called socialism in the People's Republic of China or in the Russian Federation. And in fact, quite the opposite. China is certainly not a model of social democracy by any means. It's the most oppressive form of capitalism one can possibly imagine, with sweat labor conditions extending to millions of people, with 275 million migrant workers, and those are official figures, who are integrated into the cheap labor economy. And that, in turn, feeds the Western consumer economy. We have to understand that. So that there are very important vested interests on both sides to maintain that relationship. And the Chinese government is, in fact, also responding to the interests of the Chinese capitalist class, to the traders and so on and so forth. But what is distinct to China is that they do not have, at least at this particular juncture, they do not have an imperial agenda. So that when they send their companies to Libya or to other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, they're essentially there to make money. They don't come in with a Chinese integrated command, which is going to protect their investments. That's the model. That's the U.S. model. U.S. AFRICOM is there essentially to recolonize Africa. And of course, when the Chinese come into Africa, they're not within their own, their own sphere of influence. They're within the sphere of influence, which is essentially Western. And this is something, of course, which is feared by the United States and its allies.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Global Warfare, is the U.S. NATO going to attack Russia? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You have recently been talking about global warfare in several regions of the world. First of all, what do you mean by global warfare? And in that context, could you talk at more length about what you refer to as non-conventional warfare? You mentioned this in the beginning, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Well, global warfare is a project defined at the level of U.S. foreign policy, but also in terms of U.S. military doctrine. And it is also reflected by the fact that the United States has military bases and facilities all over the world. It has its regional command structures. I can't give you the exact numbers from memory, but we're talking about military bases in over 100 countries. And deployment worldwide, not to mention, the Star Wars, the high-tech dimensions, which make it global, that they can strike anywhere in the world within very short notice. So that is what is meant by global warfare. It has to do with the organizational structures of the military, on the one hand. It has to do with the fact that we're dealing with a globalized economy, which is protected by military intelligence operations. And it has to do with the weapon systems of long-range missiles and so on and so forth. But other methods of intervention, as I mentioned, it's the so-called environmental modification techniques, climatic warfare, and so on. Very vast, and of course the communication system that we have worldwide, the surveillance system, the satellite technologies. So that is what is meant by global warfare, and it's a very scary context because, first of all, public opinion may have some understanding of some dimensions of this particular framework, but they are not aware of the sort of global implications. And I should say that within the realm of decision making, even the decision makers are not entirely aware of the global ramifications of their actions. And that's why I also stress the fact that there's the historical role of mistakes and errors and human factors, paranoia, and so on and so forth, which can insert itself within the framework of decision making. In other words, we are certainly at perhaps the most serious crossroads in world history. It's the dangers of a third world war is certainly looming. I don't think we should neglect that. I'm not suggesting it will take place. What we have to do is to formulate strategies which will enable us to undermine this agenda. When Hillary Clinton says nuclear war is on the table, I want the Iranians to know if I'm the president, we will attack Iran, we will obliterate them. That's what she said. And it was part of her previous election campaign. But nonetheless, she made that statement and she's made other statements. Now, what we're dealing with is, in fact, the outright criminalization of politics. And then there's the question of sanity and honesty in U.S. foreign policy. Well, there is no sanity and there is no honesty. And if you want to be president of the United States, you almost have to have some kind of a criminal record. Otherwise, you're not going to be elected or you're not going to be supported by the lobby groups. And why is that? Because people who have very fraudulent backgrounds, such as Hillary Clinton, are easily manipulated. In fact, we noticed that many of the regime changes are precisely that. Now, when you raise the issue of global warfare, the non-conventional forms of intervention are part of that agenda, so that when you have a regime change in Brazil or in Argentina or in Venezuela, it's part of that agenda. The mechanisms may not be military, but they're certainly intelligence, and they also have an economic dimension.
Russia is taking NATO's saber-rattling in Eastern Europe very seriously and has said that it will do whatever it takes to secure Russia's borders. The launching of the European Missile Defense System, Aegis, by the United States in May has repeatedly been criticized by Russia as an attempt by the U.S. to perhaps be able to preemptively strike Russia. Now, Russia has deployed an Iskander missile system, which would be in response to this Aegis system. What is your view of Russia's military capabilities?
Well, this Iskander It's called the SS-26 Stone Tactical Missile System. It has been around for quite some time. I don't think that we are necessarily in an entirely new environment. Russia has, or at least claims to have, the capabilities of confronting any kind of missile, so-called missile defense system, which in effect is a system of attack missiles. But I think certainly Russia is concerned, rightly concerned, first of all, regarding the military buildup, even though that doesn't necessarily signify outright war, but of course it could lead to incidents. And it has sent a message to the West that it intends to protect its borders and its territories, and it is not intent upon any kind of negotiation, e.g. with regard to Ukraine or with regard to Crimea. And at the same time, it has demonstrated to the West, particularly since its intervention in Syria, that it has very advanced aerospace capabilities, which would respond if U.S. NATO were to attack the Russian Federation. But if this were to occur, we are in a World War III scenario, particularly in view of the fact that the diplomatic relationship which existed during the Cold War is no longer there. During the Cold War, there was the hotline, there was dialogue, there was persistent exchanges between the West and the East. We don't have that anymore. And we also have a different leadership. When we've got heads of state and heads of government who are bordering onto paranoia, and I'm talking about not only in the United States, but also in Western Europe, so that the situation is potentially dangerous. But as I underscored, I don't think that this buildup is intended to attack Russia on its western frontier. It is more an issue of threatening Russia and using these threats to force Russia into making concessions to the West or accepting the West hegemony. And I think that U.S. policymakers must understand that Russia will never do that. They have fought several wars, starting with Napoleon, then World War I, and then World War II. And in World War II, they lost 10% of their population defending their homeland. So there is absolutely no feasible possibility that the United States and its allies could actually conquer this vast country. But again, within the realm of non-conventional warfare, they could certainly destabilize the Russian economy. They could create divisions, or they have, in fact, been creating divisions within the Russian Federation. And we have to look at the map. Russia and China and the various republics of the former Soviet Union, which still have alliances with the Russian Federation, it's a mass. It extends from Eastern Europe right to the Far East. And that is, of course, the area which is sought for conquest. And you can read the text of Zbigniew Brzezinski with regard to U.S. foreign policy. And in fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski's proposal, his most recent proposal, is to weaken the relationship between China and Russia. And that, in fact, they are doing that. And if that relationship were to crumble for some reason, I think then Russia would be very much isolated and much more vulnerable to U.S. endeavors in terms of military conquest and so on. But I should mention there's another important thing, is that the Russians are playing a very careful diplomacy. They are establishing bilateral relations with some of America's staunchest allies, including Israel and Saudi Arabia. And they are attempting to maintain their relationship with their partners in Western Europe, particularly Germany and France. And that, I think, is very significant. This global military agenda and this global economic agenda with its concurrent trade agreements, the TTIP and the TPP, which essentially established the contours of a colonial economic system, okay? It's an imperial project. The trade agreements are part of the imperial project. Well, at the same time, there's a lot of resistance to that within the European Union. And there are also historical ties of Western Europe to Russia, which go back several centuries. This is not something you can necessarily erase just with a stroke of U.S. foreign policy. So that the Russians are very astute diplomats, and they are also very experienced in strategic and military affairs. And that's something which U.S. Decision makers have to take into account, because if they don't, they are, in fact, precipitating the world into the unthinkable, a World War III scenario, which, in a real sense of the word, threatens the future of humanity. And mistakes, stupidity, lack of judgment in the implementation of a so-called imperial design could certainly lead the world into a global conflict.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for a very constructive analytical discussion. Delighted to be on the program.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been Global Warfare. Is the U.S. NATO going to attack Russia? Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, as well as co-editor of the anthology The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life,
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the third and final part of a new film by Adam Curtis. It's called Bitter Lake. In 1945, President Roosevelt and Saudi King Abdulaziz signed a fateful deal aboard a ship on the Great Bitter Lake at Suez. The Saudis agreed to keep the U.S. supplied with cheap oil. The U.S. agreed to protect the Saudi regime and protect the Saudis' reactionary form of Islam, Wahhabism. The term Bitter Lake also refers to a U.S.-backed dam project on the Helmand River in Afghanistan, and also to a great sea in the Soviet science fiction film Solaris. That sea disoriented and damaged the minds of all people who tried to conquer it. And, of course, that sea is a metaphor for Afghanistan, and for how every Western attempt to reform Afghanistan has only made life worse. Worse for the Afghanis, and worse for the reformers, too. This is my idea, not Curtis's, but let's paraphrase the Pete Seeger song. So if you love your Uncle Sam, support our boys in Afghanistan. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. As we pick up the film, there's a long caption. Here is Bitter Lake. At the end of the 20th century, faced with a complex and chaotic world, politicians retreated into simple stories of right and wrong, moral tales of good and evil. Politicians in America and Britain gave even more of their power away to the banks. The financial technocrats promised they could manage the new complexities. But the politicians still wanted to change the world. So they did what President Reagan had done. They ruthlessly simplified the complex struggles around the world into simple stories of good versus evil, and intervened to protect the innocent victims, as in Kosovo, 1999. Osama bin Laden sent a team of jihadists to attack what he called the far enemy, the United States. The majority were Saudis. They could get U.S. visas easily because of the special relationship between America and Saudi Arabia.
After the shock of the attacks in September 2001, the greatest fear was that the American economy might collapse as well. In response, the politicians, advised by their economic experts, cut interest rates to almost zero. This allowed cheap money to flood through the system and avoid disaster. The banks lent money to anyone and everyone. It was the politicians looking to the financial system to stabilize the country. At the same time, thousands of experts and advisors flooded into Afghanistan. Their aim was to transform the country into a modern democracy. This optimistic vision of a future Afghanistan was celebrated in the Kabul Stadium. It was the same stadium where the Russians had celebrated their new model for Afghanistan 20 years before.
Last year, we think that we never can be alive again. We will die. But now we are thinking that we are alive again, and we are too happy. And also from America, that they help a lot. We are very appreciative of them. Thanks a lot. I think now everything is normal. The man and woman can work in one place. know any difference between them, and I think everything is going to good day by day. And this is our school.
That's your school board.
All kinds of groups came to Kabul to help the project. It was like a snapshot of what those in power in America and Britain believed made democracy work. As well as the obvious lessons in how to organise elections and conferences on how to stop the narcotics trade, young Afghan students were also given lessons in how to make conceptual art.
In a small classroom in Afghanistan, a Western instructor shows a slide of the porcelain urinal that Marcel Duchamp presented as a sculpture in 1917.
So this is in some ways often called the first piece of conceptual art. Does anyone know what it is? I don't expect the ladies to know.
Toilets.
Exactly. An artist called Marcel Duchamp, who's very important in Western art, put this toilet in an art gallery about 100 years ago. It was a huge revolution.
Are you ready to see how it is used?
Underlying it all was a belief that the battle was to create a good society, one that would be strong enough to stand against the bad, anti-democratic forces that had overwhelmed Afghanistan. But then it began to get confusing. The Americans discovered that it was very difficult to know exactly who was good and who was bad. When they had invaded, they had been helped by Afghans who were already fighting the Taliban. The Americans had assumed that they would then help to create the new democracy and appointed many of them to run the country. But now it turned out that many of them were actually the very same corrupt and violent warlords who the Taliban had overthrown. And they were using their new power to terrorize the country all over again. Gulag Sherzai had been made governor of Kandahar. But he was also alleged to be making $1 million a week from running the opium trade, while at the same time siphoning off millions from the Americans in inflated contracts. When President Karzai was persuaded to remove Sherzai, he simply made him governor of another province. But he was not alone. Throughout much of Afghanistan, the warlords had returned to power. But this time it was worse. The massive influx of American money allowed them to extend their networks of bribery and corruption to every corner of Afghan society.
Afghani people are complaining about the corruption of the public officials they have to deal with, complaining of the officials' constant demands for bribes.
But the money was not just corrupting individuals. It was undermining the whole structure of society, above all the police. Rather than enforcing the law, the police had become transformed into violent militias who worked for the warlords. They organized a massive expansion of the drug trade, and they also terrorized the local people. Ordinary Afghans came to hate the police, and they saw them as the enemy. And the Americans also weren't as good as they appeared. Jack Adema had been portrayed as a hero, working with the US Special Forces to hunt down bin Laden. He had arrived in Kabul 3 years before and become a legendary figure. CBS television had made an hour-long special about the secret world of terror that Adema had discovered in the mountains. It showed a tape that he said he had found of the Al-Qaeda group training. But then, Adema was arrested. The Americans said that he was a fake. He had nothing to do with them and had conned CBS. They alleged that Adema had a dungeon hidden underneath his house in Kabul where he tortured innocent Afghans.
Where's his village? In 3 minutes, he'll be dead.
Adema was put on trial in Kabul. He insisted, though, that he had been working with the highest levels of the US military and government.
Who are you working for, man?
We were working for the US Counterterrorist Group and working with the Pentagon and some other federal agencies.
You're working with US knowledge, with US government knowledge?
We were in touch with the Pentagon sometimes five times a day at the highest level, every day.
Jack Adema was found guilty and sent to jail. But then it got even more confusing, because reports emerged that the real American military had been doing exactly the same as Jack Adema. They had set up a special torture centre in an old Soviet hangar at Bagram Air Base. Ordinary Afghans were shackled to the ceiling and subjected to all kinds of violent abuse. But they went further than Jack Adema. The reports said that two of the victims had been tortured to death.
Back to Duchamp's urinal.
Of course, it was very provocative. People were very angry. And I think it's important to understand that when this kind of art emerged, it was partly political. It was to fight against the system and say, what is art is what I think it is.
By 2006, the British and the Americans realized that their project to bring democracy to Afghanistan was failing. And large parts of the country were descending into anarchy. In Helmand, in southern Afghanistan, armed groups had risen up and there was constant fighting. The coalition were convinced that this was the return of the Taliban, and British troops were sent there to restore order and to help protect the regional government. But when the British commanders asked the Ministry of Defence for information about what was happening in Helmand, there was none. There weren't even any satellites looking at it. They had all been moved to look at Iraq. The one thing they did know was that they were going to the very heartland of the tribe that had decisively defeated the British 125 years before at the Battle of Maiwand. The British commander called a meeting of the local elders. It was in the very same town that the American engineers had built 50 years before when they were constructing the dam across the Helmand River.
We are the three who work together, the British. I know you've seen many foreigners arriving in your country.
The commander reassured the elders that the British were there to defeat the Taliban and support the regional government.
My forefathers were even here before.
Next door, his officers were preparing to entertain the elders with a showing of David Attenborough's series, The Blue Planet. But the elders thought that the British had completely misunderstood the problem. The real enemy was not the Taliban, but the corrupt and vicious government that President Karzai had installed in Helmand and was doing nothing to stop.
Until Mr. President Karzai doesn't bring a good governance, the secure situation would be the same. If you are here for 100 years, it would not be good. Once he brought good governance, good people to the government, then we have hope that security-wise will be changed.
The elders left without watching the Blue Planet. Before they came to Helmand, the British had forced President Karzai to get rid of its governor. But they didn't realise that he had left behind him a completely corrupted society. And nothing was what it seemed. When the British went into towns like Sangin, they tried to support the police. But the police were really the armed militia for the sacked governor. To the locals, this meant that the Western troops were supporting their oppressors. So they started to attack the British.
Get inside!
That's close, that one out the back there.
It was.
Right, mate, get under. See what
they're all shooting on us.
Stay down, mate, stay down.
The British thought that this must mean they were Taliban. So in response, they dropped giant bombs on them. But this then devastated the town centres, which made even more local people join in the attacks. Seeing their chance, the real ideological Taliban, who are now based in Pakistan, flooded back in, and they started attacking the British too. At the same time, the corrupt militias, who worked for the local government, also turned against the British. Faced by the chaos, the British still clung to their simple narrative of good and evil. They, the Western forces, were good. And all the different groups who were attacking them were Taliban and were bad. But this extraordinary simplification had terrible consequences. Because if you were an Afghan and wanted to kill a rival, all you had to do was go to the British and tell them that he was a Taliban. And the British would obediently wipe him out. The British were being used. The terrible truth was that the British presence did not contain the war. It did the very opposite. It escalated it so much that it ran out of control. And the bodies, Afghan and British, piled up.
The dynamic was one of manipulation. They understood how we saw the conflict. They presented their local group conflict, their civil war between groups that had been going on for 35 years. They presented everything in that dynamic. So they came to us and said, those people over there are Taliban. And we went, okay. And we went off and dealt with them. But actually, we were dealing with their previous enemies. So we were just creating more enemies for ourselves. And you ended up in a downward spiral where, because everyone was manipulating us, we ended up fighting everyone. And then in return, everyone who fought us immediately became Taliban. The way that we decided whether you were Taliban or not was whether you were firing at us. Post-2001, whereas we've understood the conflict as good, bad, black, white, government, Taliban, they've understood it as a shifting mosaic of different groups and leaders fighting each other, effectively over power. And the currency of power in Helmand is opium. That's largely what the conflict's about.
So what you're saying is that what we thought were the Taliban was actually an allergic reaction to us turning up into the middle of a complex civil war.
Correct.
We made things worse.
Yes.
But then the British and the Americans had to face up to the fact that they might not be as good and innocent as they thought they were. In 2009, the presidential elections were held. Hamid Karzai stood and allied himself with some of the most powerful warlords. But there were allegations that the warlords rigged the vote on a massive scale. This was backed up with videos that seemed to show the warlords' followers stuffing the ballot boxes with hundreds of fake voting papers. The coalition tried to rerun the election. But Karzai's main opponent refused, because he said it would be even more corrupt. So the British and the Americans had no choice but to abandon their great dream of a real democracy in Afghanistan. They gave in and allowed Karzai to become president again.
I still don't trust that fella.
Things look rather bad, sir. What are we going to do?
Do, Captain? We're British. We won't do anything.
Till it's too late.
Precisely. That's the first sensible thing you've said today.
Thank you, sir.
Now, gentlemen, as always, we will carry on as if nothing was going to happen.
This morning, the Federal Reserve, with support of the Treasury Department, took additional actions to mitigate disruptions to our financial markets. Today's events are fast-moving, but the Chairman of the Federal Reserve and the Secretary of the Treasury are on top of them and will take the appropriate steps to promote stability in our markets.
And at the very same time as their simple plan was falling apart in Afghanistan, the politicians had to face a crisis at home. They had given power to the banks because the bankers and the financial technocrats had promised that they could hold the economy stable. But in 2008, the whole intricate system of credit and loans that the banks had created collapsed. And there was growing panic as giant financial institutions faced bankruptcy. The politicians in America and Britain stepped in and rescued the banks. As they did so, they began to discover that most of the major financial institutions were also riddled with corruption. But unlike President Roosevelt in the 1930s, they didn't then try and reform the system. Instead, they simply propped it up by literally pouring billions more pounds and dollars into the banks, hoping that this would somehow spread through the economies. They had no other idea. And faced by disaster in Afghanistan, the politicians did exactly the same there too. The Americans knew that the idea of democracy was failing. In desperation, they poured even more money into the Afghan economy. The idea was that this would somehow create a simpler economic form of democracy, and that the free market would liberate people. They would become model consumers, following their own rational self-interest, just like in the economies of the West. And in an odd way, it worked. Many of those in charge of the money did behave in their own rational self-interest. They simply stole the money, smuggled it out through Kabul airport, and used it to buy luxury properties in Dubai. During this period, it was estimated that $10 million a day was being taken out of Afghanistan this way. The scandal seemed to confirm for many Afghans that the United States had not brought democracy or free markets to their country, but instead a corrupt crony capitalism that had taken over Afghanistan and its government. Which was the very same allegation that was being made against politicians at home, in America and in Britain. At the end of 2014, British soldiers left Afghanistan. All the bases were wiped out, as if nothing had been there. Even the war memorials were packed up and taken back to Staffordshire. But they weren't the only fighters who had left Afghanistan. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had gone to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets back in the 1980s. Then he had stayed on to work with Osama bin Laden. And in 2003, he went to Iraq and set up a jihadist group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq to fight the American invasion. Al-Zarqawi was powerfully influenced by bin Laden's ideas, but he took them much further. He and his group killed anyone who they decided did not believe in their fundamentalist ideas and deserved to die. Even the original founders of Al-Qaeda were shocked, and they sent him a letter telling him to stop killing civilians. But al-Zarqawi ignored them. He was convinced that the insurgency in Iraq could be used to spread an Islamist revolution throughout the Arab world.
If God is willing, within the next 3 months, I will rule the Islamic world.
But before he could do this, the Americans found al-Zarqawi and dropped a large bomb on him. But it didn't stop the spread of the idea. Despite al-Zarqawi's death, his organization survived and began to mutate into something even more ferocious and ambitious. But as it did so, it was possessed by ghosts from the past. What re-emerged was the fierce, intolerant vision of Wahhabism that had survived from the 1920s. It had spread outwards through Afghanistan in the 1980s and 90s, where it had become mixed with modern Islamist ideas. But now, faced by the nihilistic horror of post-invasion Iraq, any idea of building a new revolutionary future disappeared. And instead, the conservative and backward-looking Wahhabism became the dominating influence, with its desire to retreat to an imagined past. In 2013, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant was formed, known as ISIS in the West. Its aim is to create a unified caliphate throughout the Islamic world. And although it uses the techniques of modern media, it is at heart the same violent dream that had driven the Bedouins who had created the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the 1920s. Back then, the King of Saudi Arabia had found it necessary to try and exterminate them, because they too wanted to go on and conquer the whole of the Islamic world. He machine-gunned them in the bleak sands of the Arabian Peninsula. And now, the Saudis, along with the British and the Americans, are trying to do the same thing again, to kill the jihadists and their ideas in the sand dunes of northern Iraq and Syria. But it is an uncertain war. Western politicians are having to accept that the simple division between good and evil doesn't exist. By bombing ISIS, they are helping the evil President Assad to remain in power. And those in charge don't even know how big a threat ISIS really is. Is it a dark existential threat? Or is it really a front being used in an ongoing complex power struggle inside Iraq? We just don't know. At the end of the Soviet science fiction film, Solaris, the astronaut returns home. Everything seems real and normal, but somehow he doesn't trust in anything any longer. Although we have returned from Afghanistan, our leaders also seem to have lost faith in anything. And the simple stories they tell us don't make sense any longer. The experience of Afghanistan has made us begin to realize that there is something else out there, but we just don't have the apparatus to see it. What is needed is a new story, and one that we can believe in.
And that's the end of Adam Curtis's new film, Bitter Lake, condensed and adapted to radio by yours truly. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find an archive of our shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that's me, myself, and our foreign correspondent, moi. On behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, with three suggestions. Illegitimite non carborundum. Remember that Allah and Jehovah are the same God. And if you love your Uncle Sam, bring him home, bring him home. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today's show is going to focus on the 28 pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry. Many of us in the 9/11 Truth Movement feel that the current effort underway now by former Senator Bob Graham and several current congressmen like Walter Jones to declassify the 28 redacted pages of the 2002 Congressional Joint Inquiry into 9/11 is really a red herring, a psyop, a strategy, a manipulation, some sort of limited hangout to influence current geopolitics while at the same time reinforcing the official conspiracy theory about what happened on 9/11, which, if you've been listening to this show, you know is a total fabrication. Most of us in the 9/11 Truth Movement don't oppose the declassification of the 28 pages, but many of us are also concerned about the way some in the 9/11 Truth Movement have been touting the official story as a way to get these 28 pages declassified. Because of our concerns, several of us got together and created our own website, which you can find at 28pagesrevealed.info. And you can also use .com or .net or .org, I think. You'll also get there. Today I'm joined on the show by two like-minded people who have similar concerns. First, we have Ken Freeland. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hi, sir.
Ken is a founding member of the Houston 9/11 Truth Group and is also a facilitator of the monthly 9/11 Truth and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference. And also joining me is Nita Renfrew from New York. Welcome, Nita.
Yes. Hi. Nice to be here.
Nita Renfrew has worked in public affairs at the highest levels of government internationally and was later a journalist specializing in national security, Central America, and the Middle East. She was the U.S. correspondent for the Spanish edition of Le Monde Diplomatique. So it's really great to have both of you on the show. So one of my concerns about the way many are describing the 28 pages is that they say it will give us the truth about what happened on 9/11. The Joint Congressional Inquiry, in my opinion, is a limited fraudulent investigation and was only tasked with looking into intelligence failures. And they just accepted the government version of the 19 Middle Eastern men with box cutters. That whole story is so full of holes, but is still being passed off as the truth. So every time they discuss the 28 pages in the news, it reinforces the fraudulent official conspiracy theory, only now they add that the Saudis did it. They leave out any mention of controlled demolition and that many of the alleged hijackers are still alive. Either of you two want to respond or add anything to that?
Well, I'd like to say that the whole allegation that it was the Saudis goes back to the neocons soon after 9/11. And parallel with the neocons, the LaRouche organization began to come out with its version of it was the Saudis. And, of course, with them, it's always the Queen of England and Britain and the Saudis. And so it's important to know that it dates back to neocon publications. And on our website, we have an excellent article, which is Who Are the Neoconservatives?, written by the French historian Laurent Guillenot. And I would urge everybody to go to the website and read this article because it basically explains the history of the neocons and how it leads up to their basically wanting us to invade Iraq in the 1990s and their PNAC manifesto, which we'll get into later, I guess, which is relevant to this, and the fact that they began blaming the Saudis early on after 9/11. So I see this as it's sort of a revival of that. It was obviously built into the report so that they could bring it out as a red herring. And I think that, you know, the best description of what it is was given by Barbara Honegger at the Left Forum presentation that you organized, Cheryl. And I urge everyone to see that, too. The link is also on the website. And, you know, just take it from there.
Yeah, she did a really great job of that. I agree. Actually, I aired an edited and shortened version of
her powerful presentation a few weeks ago on the show, and you can find that at radioforall.net. And of course, as Nita mentioned, it's on our website, 28pagesrevealed.info. Ken, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think, well, a couple of things. First of all, some illustrious writer, and I don't remember who it was, opined early on in the 9/11 truth movement's history that there were several fallback positions that had already been created in the event that the government's official version started wearing thin. And this was to blame 9/11 on other external actors other than Osama bin Laden and the 19 hijackers. One of these was Saudi Arabia. Another was Pakistan. There were several others in the mix. And I think we are seeing that that prophecy has sort of been manifested in what we've seen in the news of late. The other thing, just briefly, the I think that Cheryl mentioned in the introduction here of the Congressional Joint Inquiry was not to discover the causes of 9/11. It was to highlight the causes of the so-called intelligence failure. And if we dwell on that for a minute, we realize that the intelligence failure itself is a red herring, because if 9/11 was indeed, to some extent, an inside job, there was no failure involved at all. It was actually, what would we say, a deliberate misfeasance on the part of the so-called intelligence community, if you don't mind the oxymoron there, that's very popular. So bearing that in mind, what can we expect to find in the 28 pages? Well, there may, in fact, be some threads there that can be pulled and lead to other threads and so forth and so on that might ultimately reveal more truth about 9/11 than the perpetrators would like to have revealed. But that's a big if, given the original purpose of the congressional investigation.
Right, and they're getting so much mileage out of blaming it on the Saudis and reinforcing the official conspiracy theory in people's minds as they go about that. So, yeah. So that brings me to the next point, and why now? Why are they all of a sudden, almost 15 years later, bringing out these 28 pages and Saudi involvement? Has the 9/11 truth movement been doing such a great job that they're getting nervous and they've got to kind of take the blame away from the real perpetrators? Or what do you think's going on here?
Well, it's kind of a big subject, but again, we look at the current geopolitical developments, the strain in relations with Saudi Arabia, the back-and-forth cat-and-mouse game being played by Obama and the representatives of Saudi Arabia, and this certainly represents a political football of pretty immense magnitude that could be thrown around to make the mix a little more volatile and bring about political leverage as needed. So there's always that possibility, to state the more obvious, but there are others, I'm sure. Nita, do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, I think that it's been almost 15 years now since 9/11. And during that time, a lot of evidence, pretty good circumstantial evidence, has surfaced pointing to Israel and the neoconservatives in this country. And I think that it's possible that they pulled out the Saudi thing because they felt that there was too much focus on what maybe really did happen, and they pulled out this prepared thing. Now, you know, the problem with, and here comes the whole thing, you know, when we talk about the 9/11 truth movement, I personally think that we need to get away from the idea of the 9/11 truth movement, because I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who are behaving like infiltrators in leadership positions in the 9/11 truth movement, and particularly I'm in New York City, and I see this happening in New York City, and I think that it's sort of a self-defeating purpose. It's self-defeating to want to maintain unity, because why would you want to maintain unity with the same people that are trying to pull down the real search for the truth? Personally, I'm perfectly willing, if I see evidence, I'm perfectly willing to believe that Saudi Arabia carried out this whole operation and that they were able to gain access to the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon and place explosives in there and so on, if I see some evidence. I'm not closed to it, but there's a lot more evidence that Israel was involved with it and their allies here in the United States, which Barbara Honegger points to, and she points out in her Behind the Smoke Curtain, which everybody should watch, and it's also linked on the website.
And again, that website is 28pagesrevealed.info.
And everybody should watch that, because she has a whole section where she says who was behind it, and she describes the neocons and the positions they held during the Bush administration and so on. So clearly, this 28 pages with a focus on the Saudi, the campaign that's being run, especially out of New York City, which is ground zero, which is, makes it very important, is taking the attention away from that and putting it on Saudi Arabia, which, you know, may or may not have had any kind of a role, and it appears now that it was a role maybe in the cover-up, which doesn't mean that they knew that they were being part of a cover-up. I mean, I doubt that they would have said to them, look, you know, you're going to pay for a cover-up. And, you know, Saudi Arabia, it's well documented that they have been giving blank checks to the United States for black operations, to the CIA and other organizations here for many years without participating in them. So the way I see it is, you know, they would have maybe given money, maybe they just gave a blank check to the U.S. government and saw it as protection money from the mob. So I think that the fact that they're bringing the Saudi connection out now would indicate that there's enough evidence coming out to show that it was indeed certain persons within the U.S. government and think tanks and so on that were behind it, and namely the neocons and their fellow travelers, and Israel.
Right, and if you look at the Saudi involvement, what their supposedly their connection is that they funded two of the alleged hijackers, and one of those two was known to be alive after 9/11. So, you know, that's also another interesting point, which former Senator Bob Graham and the people pushing for the 28 pages declassification don't mention. So that's also very interesting. And then there's also Senator Bob Graham and Porter Goss, who were the two heads of the Congressional Joint Inquiry, were having breakfast on the morning of 9/11 with the head of the Pakistani ISI, their intelligence agency, which works very close with the CIA. And he actually had money sent to Mohammed Atta and had to resign from his position when that came out, I think, in the Indian press. So no one's pointing any finger at the Pakistanis. And I find that very interesting. I was reading in a book by Paul Rea in his book Mounting Evidence that even the Pakistanis were supposedly like bribing the 9/11 commission that came out 2 years later after the joint inquiry to not include them in their report and their involvement in it. So, but nobody's even talking about that.
Well, what would the Pakistani motive be any more than the Saudis? I mean, they were doing the CIA's work also. And Mohammed Atta was apparently alive afterwards, and his father said in an interview that, you know, that if they wanted to find him, to call the Mossad. And I've seen quite a few articles that document his ongoing relationship with the CIA over the years and the fact that he was not religious. And there again, he's an alleged hijacker who was alive after the alleged hijacking.
Right. And both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have very little to gain from pulling off a 9/11. So I guess the point I was making is that the media and the government are really fine-tuning where they're taking this, and there's an agenda there. And that,
definitely.
Yeah, and I guess that takes us to my next thought or question, which is...
Before the next question, I wanted to comment on Porter Goss and Bob Graham. There's an old saying, show me your friends and I'll tell you who you are. And this gets back to the point I think Nita was making earlier about the suspicious nature of the way in which this whole 28 pages is being presented by people who, as members of the 9/11 truth community, ought to know better. But both Graham and Goss, as you mentioned, have this original connection with some of the people who are involved, at least tangentially, with 9/11. And Porter Goss, in particular, has a very, very deep, shady, spooky background that we've depicted to some degree on our website, 28pagesrevealed.info. But I hope we can enrich that further, because his connection with the CIA goes way, 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 way back. In fact, some people place him as far back as the Fording Committee, which some people claim was involved in the JFK assassination. So in any case, these are shady characters from the word go, both of them. And to consider these as being the spearheads of a movement behind which the truth movement is supposed to unify itself, all the while presenting the official story as the key to understanding 9/11, is very, 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 very telling, in my view, about whatever it is that these people are trying to accomplish. But it's not revealing the causes and the perpetrators of 9/11. Nothing else. I don't know what it is, but it's not that.
Right. It's a very big distraction from all the real research that the 9/11 truth movement has gathered over the last 15 years.
And if I could add one more thing, if we look at this in perspective, yeah, it would be nice to know what's in those 28 pages, particularly because it would prevent some of the folks in the press and other places for making innuendos about what might be in there as if it were definitely in there. But more importantly, I think we could just compare it to, say, for example, the content of the Pentagon security cameras. I mean, from the standpoint of the 9/11 truth movement, which one is going to reveal a lot more information than we already know about what happened on 9/11?
Right.
Some obscure corner of a congressional report that wasn't even about the causes of 9/11, or some actual hard evidence about what actually did or didn't hit the Pentagon? I mean, come on.
Right. There's a lot of other information that we haven't been given that's out there that, that would be much more valuable and important than these 28 pages. Yeah, I agree.
I'd like to say something here about that. I think that one of the things that we need to do, those of us who really do want the truth to come out in the 9/11 truth movement, I would say that the other people probably aren't part of the 9/11 truth movement. They're just part of the 9/11 movement. But I think what we need to do is we need to compile a comprehensive list of everything that we would like to have declassified. And I would actually add, you know, there was that article in the New York Times, that front page article that showed on Saturday, last Saturday, showing that there is absolutely no hard evidence linking the Saudis to 9/11. And the one thing they did mention was that consular office, who was a sheikh, Muslim sheikh at a mosque in California, they said that there were recorded conversations of him with al-Bayoumi, who he claimed was not true. So we should actually ask for those pages so we can see the telephone records. Of course, telephone records can be manufactured, but we could trace it down. I think that if we had a comprehensive list of everything that we do want classified, we could find, and this, I'm saying this from my public affairs background, we could find some allies in Washington, in the government and in the Congress and the Senate, and try to push that and get some public notice of that in a more comprehensive manner. And I'm sure we would find some allies down there. I'm sure there are people who say, yes, the 28 pages, but let's get more.
Just
right.
To clarify, you mean everything we want declassified, right?
Everything we want declassified.
That's a really great idea, and I hope we can add that to our website. I hope we can really create that and add it to our website. And getting back to something else that you had said earlier, both of you alluded to, is, you know, we have this group in the 9/11 Truth Movement who are working sort of with the government on this, working with Senator Bob Graham, or former Senator Bob Graham, and they're kind of repeating the official story in order to do this. And you mentioned infiltration, and we know we're infiltrated. I mean, we've had Cass Sunstein, who was in the government working under Obama, talk about how to infiltrate us, et cetera. He talked about cognitive infiltration. So this could be an example of that. And, you know, we don't know for certain, but we know we're infiltrated. So I think we need to keep that in mind and be aware of that.
Well, if we're infiltrated, what's the most important place? That's New York City, because this is where 9/11 took place. And the people who organize the functions here and everything, in the last 9/11 full day of talks and so on here, at which you were present, Cheryl, Barbara Honegger and Wayne Madison, who were both present, both were given explicit instructions that they could not mention Israel as a condition for participating in this whole day conference. And when you look at who's giving those instructions and why those instructions, you have to say, well, you know, if these people are not infiltrators, they're behaving like infiltrators. And one of the things that happens is that sometimes infiltrators actually get a hold of other people and who are unwitting parties to the infiltration. And, for instance, I see a lot of reliance on the advice coming out of the LaRouche group in their claims that it was Saudi Arabia and that the 28 pages is going to reveal everything, and they're backing the families that are trying to sue Saudi Arabia for damages. And you really got to ask, what is going on and why are people accepting conditions like this in order to present? Well, the reason people are accepting is because it's like, you know, when there are only a certain amount of forums around, you want to at least be able to get out what you can get out. But I think that this is clear evidence that there's infiltration at that level.
I think it's very difficult to prove positively that someone or some group is a perpetrator. Well, I think it's relatively easy to allay suspicion, and the way that that's done is by looking at how much 9/11 truth they're actually divulging. So if we take a look, for example, at the HR14.org website, okay, and we look on it, that's a website that claims to be promoting, well, actually is promoting the 28 pages declassification. But we look on it for evidence of 9/11 truth, and we don't find any there, okay? I mean, there are some basic understandings in the 9/11 truth movement that dispute and repudiate the official conspiracy theory.
And we just don't find any evidence of that anywhere on that website. And I think that that is a telling sign of something going on other than 9/11 truth. I can't say it's positive proof of infiltration or a subversive effort of our movement, but it certainly is saving somebody a lot of money who right. wants to accomplish those purposes, okay?
Right, and it really harms the 9/11 truth movement, I think. Also, if one goes to that website and looks at it today, they've actually tried to beef it up a little because of our complaints over the last year. They've tried to make it look a little bit more like a 9/11 truth website, but it isn't. And they still didn't accomplish that very well, but it's like one slight hair better than it was a year ago. Yeah, good points. I also wanted to talk briefly about the confusion generated by this focus on the 28 redacted pages from the Congressional Joint Inquiry Report. First, former Senator Bob Graham says it implicates the Saudis in 9/11. Then some of the 9/11 commissioners who wrote the 9/11 Commission Report, which came out 2 years after the Congressional Joint Inquiry Report, and supposedly looked into the Saudi connection to 9/11, saying that what's in the 28 redacted pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry is actually in the 9/11 Commission Report, and they found no evidence linking the Saudis to 9/11. And that's just one example of some of the confusion around these 28 pages. So what's going on here? Is this intentionally created confusion?
Well, I think this is the kind of problem we end up with when vital information is withheld in the first place. There's absolutely no reason why this should ever have been declassified. And let's remember that Bob Graham was part of the congressional body that was involved in the classification of it in the first place. So I think this kind of confusion is inevitable when something is secret and then there's all kinds of curiosity about it. Also, there have been rumors from some of the people that supposedly know the truth that all the information in the 28 pages is unvetted and therefore unreliable. So we've heard that little report too. So again, how much of our money, how much of the 9/11 truth movement's money do we want to bet on this pig in the poke? You know, it's really, really questionable.
Right. And I think it's really important to repeat again that both the Joint Congressional Inquiry and the 9/11 Commission report were very flawed, controlled, almost worthless investigations. So anything in them should be taken with grain of salt, a question mark. And much of the information they gathered was through torture, which we know isn't reliable. So I think that needs to be said. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that either of you would like to bring up?
Yeah, I guess I'd just like to reemphasize the point I just made. A real problem with all of this that takes us a little bit beyond looking at this issue is just this whole question of classification in the first place. And, you know, the theory of a republic like we supposedly live in is that the people have the right to all the information they need to make intelligent political decisions. And we're essentially being denied that information left and right. So that in itself is a major issue that needs to be addressed. But, of course, that takes us beyond the question of the 9/11 truth movement. But still in all, it's something that weighs on my mind heavily a lot as I look over this issue.
Yes, it is a really serious issue. And I think that's a big reason why we in the 9/11 truth movement do what we do, to try and get the truth out about 9/11. Because many Americans are currently supporting U.S. policies and very destructive U.S. policies based on totally fraudulent information. So hopefully our new website, 28pagesrevealed.info, will help people at least get a handle on the whole 28 pages ploy that we're being manipulated with right now. And Nita, are there any final points that you'd like to make today?
Well, I'd just like to say that I think that what we need to do is, those of us who really do want to find the truth, we need to concentrate on getting declassification of the things that we know are going to, or that we believe are going to show what really happened, like what Ken mentioned, the tapes of the Pentagon. There's a whole lot of those things that could be declassified, and if those of us who really do want the truth focus on that, if we had focused on that in the way that these 28 pages campaign had been run, we'd be a lot farther ahead with the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'd like to see us do.
Right, that's a good point. And hopefully, as I said, we can expand that section on our website with that information. And again, that web address is 28pagesrevealed.info. It's a very user-friendly website. We've got lots of great links to articles, and there's a lot of information up there about the Joint Congressional Inquiry and those 28 pages. There's a lot of information there about Senator Bob Graham and Porter Goss, so you know their background. We've outlined our problem and why we created the website. There's a lot of information there about the Saudis and other players, and we keep expanding on it. So do check it out. Again, it's 28pagesrevealed.info. Well, thanks very much, Ken Freeland and Nita Renfrew, for being on the show today.
Thank you, Cheryl.
You're welcome, Cheryl. It's an honor.
To sum up today's discussion on the 28 pages from the Joint Congressional Inquiry of 2002, I'm going to read a few lines from an article by Professor Michelle Chusadovsky. This article can be found on our website, 28pagesrevealed.info, and here goes. The 28 pages have nothing to do with 9/11 truth. This alleged Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks has served to precipitate segments of the 9/11 truth movement into an erroneous and contradictory discourse. It is part of a propaganda ploy. Because Bob Graham accuses the FBI and the federal government, the 9/11 truth movement applauds without realizing that these accusations directed against the FBI are, quote, framed with a view to sustaining the mainstream 9/11 narrative. And now I'd like to tell you about our progressive movie night coming up on June 29th at 7 p.m. It'll be in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And the movie we're going to be showing is called State of Mind, The Psychology of Control. That's a great film. So again, it's going to be on Wednesday, June 29th at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And parking is free in Lot B. Hope to see you there. And just a reminder, 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four. So radioforall.net. And once on the site, look under Cheryl with a C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake-Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Everybody's got a pain inside. Imaginary wounds that they try to hide. How can I get them? When everybody's got a pulse. Wants my soul. It tells me if I hate, I can control. But I don't believe it. Cause everybody's got a pulse. I am human. I am love. And my heart beats in my blood. Love will always win. Underneath the skin, 'cause everybody's got a pulse. Once again I hang my head to cry, 'cause I can't find the reason why they died. We will find the answer blowing in the wind, 'cause everybody's got a pulse.
Melissa Etheridge's anthem to the 49 killed and more than 50 wounded at the Club Pulse in Orlando.
Now a clip from the newly released film From Selma to Stonewall. Are we there yet?
Here we go.
Because I keep saying that this is an American story.
Yes.
A very American. It's an American as apple pie.
Knowing that a group is gathered for the same reason, you know, there's an immediate kind of solidarity.
And the most gated neighborhood in the world is the human heart. And legislation can only do so much. There's an interior work, there's a soul work that must be done.
The visibility of police abuse of black men, I liken that to the police abuse of the first people who gathered at Selma. Mm-hmm. That Bloody Sunday was a police riot.
There may be some in this auditorium. There may be some here today that will be homosexual in the future. Because one out of three of you will turn queer. And if we catch you involved with a homosexual, your parents are going to know about it first. And you will be caught. Don't think you won't be caught.
One of my dearest friends in the civil rights movement, and he said, Martin Luther King did not die, nor did we march for two men to sleep together.
That the homophobia in the black community is real. It's most profound in the church and needs to be addressed.
If there is a stonewall, it's because of black trans sisters who are out there raising hell and making noise.
These young LGBT homeless youth off the streets. Get them off the streets.
About 40% of the homeless population identify as LGBTQ.
To say, in spite of the fact that I'm poor and black and dark-skinned and gay, and I am a human being. I am loved by God. As the psalmist says, I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
just as there are flaws in the civil rights movement, there are flaws in this movement that I'm identifying as taking us there. But then it is in the intersections. It is in the intersections that we will find the new world.
From Selma to Stonewall, are we there yet? Gil Caldwell is a retired Methodist minister, activist, and a self-described foot soldier in the civil rights movement who marched on Washington, called for voting rights in the heat of the Mississippi summer, and walked from Selma to Montgomery. He later broadened his demand for equality, advocating for gay rights. In 2000, he was arrested twice for protesting the United Methodist Church's policy that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Gil Caldwell is co-executive producer of From Selma to Stonewall.
Marilyn Bennett is a lesbian author and activist who developed The Truth and Progress, a multimedia project focused on race, sexual orientation, and religion. The project pays homage to historic events and people of the civil rights and gay rights movements. Marilyn Bennett is director and co-executive producer of From Selma to Stonewall.
And the film delves into some of today's most explosive and discussed subjects. Of course, the question is, how they're discussed. It delves into racial injustice and police brutality and transgender discrimination, LGBTQ homelessness, and where those issues intersect. The film takes on a heightened importance, most particularly after the horror of the massacre of gay, primarily Latinos, Latinas, in Orlando. And Marilyn Bennett, Gil Caldwell, let's begin with the intersection of the film with the events that unfolded in Orlando. For me, the film has particular resonance in conjunction with that. What about yourselves? Marilyn and then Gil?
I think that the massacre is such a horrible event, and I think the intersections that I see, of course, are race-motivated killing, it being a Latino, Latina night at the bar, and then also an LGBTQ event and bar. But we also, I think, we see an intersection of religion in this instance, because so much religion, conservative religion, has been in the airwaves creating fear around transgender, the whole bathroom thing, the backlash to marriage equality. So I think, one, we see the intersection of racism and heterosexism, and then we also see a discriminatory background.
Gil?
I want to begin by, in fact, sort of thinking, Marilyn, something I've not thought about. I've just wondered, in terms of the intersections, I wonder how much have we been shaped by my experience as a black person, and, of course, the outsideness that, of course, gives, and your experience as a female. Wondering whether or not that has sharpened our focus and our commitment to eradicate racism, heterosexism. That's just a question that I would put out there. But it just seems to me that clearly we must cease the kind of silo justice activity and see the intersections. Martin King said it so very well. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I think that's been sort of my leading light. And as of course I responded to Orlando with the pain that caused, first those families and those persons who were there, I could not help but think of this kind of pulling together of issues of homophobic heterosexism and racism and other isms, et cetera. And therefore I find myself grieving, as I have not grieved for a long time. And therefore I think I brought to my reaction, my response, this whole process that Marilyn and I have been involved in terms of thinking about the intersections in all aspects of life.
Marilyn, I watched the film over the weekend, and I thought it was really, really good, not only in the message, but also the way it was put together.
Oh, thank you.
It was really, really good. Could you tell us more about how these issues are dealt with in the film, both in terms of the method and also the issues?
I don't know that I'd recommend this way of filmmaking, but it was a very organic process. and I say that with tongue in cheek because it took so long for us to finish the film. But it was an organic process. We wanted to really look at the civil rights movement, honor Gil's work, honor the work of the foot soldiers, and then look at the LGBT queer equality movement and see how see what people would say about them both. There's a tension there that gays would use the civil rights or refer to the equality movement as the new civil rights. And, you know, there's a lot of tension there. So we started out really going throughout the country and asking questions. We didn't have, we weren't looking for particular answers. We were genuinely looking to hear what people had to say about it. And what happened immediately was that we were hearing from people at the intersection, Black queer people, queer people of color. And we realized that those voices are often not heard in either community. So the Black community, the LGBT community, that those aren't static communities, and they're not mutually exclusive. So with that, we began to see, well, we need to move away from comparisons and move away from any competition and move to compassion. At the same time, while we were doing this project, Trayvon Martin was shot, then George Zimmerman was acquitted, Ferguson blew up, and on and on. And so we knew we'd already added the tagline, "Are we there yet?" And that then became at least the third act of the film, because we could look at Selma and we could present that history and through the eyes of Gil, who was there, and then look at Stonewall. But really it was, okay, where are we now? And what do we need to be talking about? Yes, there's marriage equality, but there are, you know, a record high rate of trans homicides. There's, you know, 40% of youth that are homeless are LGBT. We have police brutality. We have, you know, we have all these things, the erosion of the Voting Rights Act. So it was like, okay, let's get into today. Let's really dig in and hear that. So I think because we did this organic process, it allowed us to really be present to what's happening today.
One of the things that to me was most significant in the film was you deal with people holistically. People are LGBTQ people, but they are people who are Muslims. They are people who are African Americans. They are people who are Wimbern. There are people who are Latino, etc. It begins to show the entire complement of a human being and the making of a human being. And within that, very often, the multiple oppressions and pains and societal inequities that people face. And I just thought the way that was laid out was so pertinent and so potent. You then place a good deal of emphasis on the work that hasn't been done, indeed the antagonistic relationship that has been stimulated to LGBTQ sisters and brothers from the faith-based community. And Gil, particularly as a retired Methodist minister, I wonder if you can direct your attention to the systemic nature of oppression that affects this community of people or communities of peoples.
That's an important question. And as one who's involved as a United Methodist clergy person and obviously rooted in a faith tradition, we have not been honest about our sacred text, that we have found it difficult to acknowledge that in our sacred text there are certain scriptures, certain words that have been, of course, I say, misinterpreted, but in fact can be used, if you would, to diss people for just a host of reasons. I would suggest, and of course I speak as a member, a person of the Christian faith, but as you look at Bible, one can find in Scripture rationale for people who are looking for rationale to boost their hatred, to be anti-Semitic, to be racist, to be heterosexist, to be classist, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of my concerns about the faith community is that, of course, scriptures have not changed, but in fact, we have changed because we have reinterpreted them in terms of the totality of scripture, but we have not talked about that. So we've not said, for instance, vis-a-vis this curse of Ham that has justified oppression, the oppression of blacks, we've not been really open about how, when that happened, that was a misinterpretation of scripture. We, the church, religion was wrong, and we have not really admitted the wrongness, and therefore we've engaged in seriatim, a kind of oppression, women, gays, etc., etc. So I think that's a critique, and I have found myself saying, particularly since I've been involved in this project, in terms of it's important for us to acknowledge as people of faith that we've been off the track in terms of some of the use of our scriptures and some of our interpretations. And if we could acknowledge that, then in fact that should reshape the way we respond to persons whom we sort of delegate as being the other.
And so, Marilyn, I'm very much interested in, from Selma to Stonewall, the desire clearly for intersectionality and bringing the two together, but I'm most interested in what both yourself and Gil feel are some of the alienation within those communities of people as to comparing or seeing, well, I shouldn't say comparing, but seeing the oppression as severe and the angst that is created for both groups and kind of joining them in a manner of speaking from Selma to Stonewall, looking at them with a certain singularity. What do you think?
I want to go back to when we started the multimedia portion of our project, because Gil and I had been writing letters for a few years back and forth, really intentionally entering a conversation where we would say, be honest about how we are feeling. And it was things that maybe whites and blacks don't talk about, or men and women, or gays and straights. And so we were taking a risk to do that. And with the election of President Obama in 2008, in California, while Obama was elected, Prop 8 passed. So there, the saying of the man, the marriage is only between one man and one woman. And there was about a 36 to 48 hour news run where there were people in the gay community saying, well, it was the African Americans who came out to vote in great numbers for Obama, but then they voted to pass Prop 8. And and that just wasn't true. And it was debunked, and that was, you know, proven wrong fairly quickly. But there's that kind of that really showed us a tension and a conflict that needed to be addressed. So that's why we really came into looking at both of these movements. And there's a lot of emotion around that. I think that the LGBTQ community has to honor what the civil rights movement did and not take anything for granted. As a white person in the LGBTQ community, I mean, we have to really see who has come before us. And then, as one of the characters in the show says, we have to look at the fact that there was black and brown trans people leading the fight in Stonewall, and there was Baird Rustin in the civil rights movement, a black gay man. And so through our studying these two movements, we found already that of people that were there at the intersection fighting and making a difference.
How and when did you make these connections? You were active, obviously, in the civil rights movement, and then after a while, probably after Stonewall, but maybe not, tell us, when did you start advocating for civil rights for gay individuals and groups?
I guess using a church term, I had an epiphany moment, I guess in the 70s, and it of course relates to civil rights. I was greatly impressed by a white Episcopal priest who was a writer, who was a college campus minister, who was very active in the civil rights movement as a freedom bus rider. His name was Malcolm Boyd. Malcolm Boyd, in the 70s, came out as a gay man, came out to his Episcopal church and came out, I guess, to the nation. And I found myself, when that happened, for moments, wrestling with what I discovered was some innate homophobia within my own life that I had not touched base with. I found myself asking, do I deny that he's impacted my life and my ministry? Do I burn his books, I sort of said with a smile on my face? Or simply do I dismiss the fact that I have found myself in a relationship with this person whom I did not know was gay? But then as I went through that process, reason took over, hopefully my faith took over, and I realized how foolish that was. And so as a result of that, I found myself internally connecting the movements and realizing that the racism that I have been fighting really since my birth in 1933 also could enable me to be involved in fighting homophobic heterosexism. And so I guess back in the 70s, that kind of personal moment therefore became an outward moment in terms of my writing and in terms of my involvement as an ally advocate of gay rights.
And I'd like to ask both of you, the film, as Ken said, and I certainly echo it, had tremendous resonance for me. It has tremendous depth and poignancy. And certainly the overarching issue of bigotry, of disparate treatment, of discrimination in any context is so carefully taught and we are plied with it, I think, systemically from cradle to death. Fighting it becomes the issue. Educating others to join the freedom train from Selma to Stonewall. Is that what you most hope that this film will do, to bring people on board who are not there yet, to recognize the imperative of fighting the discrimination that is heaped upon the LGBTQ community, and most stridently on the transgendered community who has suffered horrifying brutality and indeed death in many, many recent years? Marilyn, Gil?
I think, my jazz approach is coming forth, so I'm going to respond. That may not be directly related.
Got a little improvisation there?
Yeah. Well, it seems to be bridges is part of the theme that you're working with. Is that you and your colleague, or is this WBAI? I remember reading Bridges. Is that correct?
Building Bridges, indeed.
Exactly. Yeah. That's of course sort of jumped out at me, and it seems to me, and I guess I found myself thinking of the need to build bridges to the past as well as to the present and the future, because I think that it's important for all of us to visit within ourselves. Why have we allowed these isms to surface within us? As you were talking, I was thinking of the song from South Pacific, "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught the People to Love, the People to Hate by the time you're 6, 7, or 8. And I guess I think persons, groups of persons, as well as a nation, would be helped if we really assess how, in fact, we developed these hatreds. And, of course, James Baldwin talked about going back to where you started from and tell the truth about it. And, of course, Santa Anna talked about if you do not remember your history, then you're bound to repeat it. So I'm trying, and maybe you can help us in this conversation, to see how we as a nation, how we as people can revisit our history with its racial, its gender contradictions in order to deal with the present and the future. I think we've been so excited about our creeds that we've ignored the negative deeds that have been ours as an American people, and I think we need to sort of surface that.
Yeah, I think that it's just beyond me how people can't see each other's humanity, that they can't see that a transgender person is another fellow human being, that a bar full of dancing, celebrating people, they are not human. They are not connected to you. I just don't understand that. Keeping people in slavery, not understand that these are humans. And the same as you. I don't know how to break into that. How to, for people that hold so tightly to their superiority over others. What I do know is that there are a lot of people that do see each other's humanity, and what happens when those people come together? Because that's a lot of people. And how do we get out of our separate lives or perceived identities, get out of communities, and move together to a new place to build that bridge and create a new path together? And I think most of all, the film is about that. How do we move together? This film, if someone is entrenched in their belief system that LGBT people are just evil and horrible and whatever, I doubt this film will change their mind. But there are a lot of people that maybe they've been afraid to say that they do stand with LGBTQ people of all colors, of all religions. If those people need the courage to make that stand, this film can help them do that. The people who are already active, this film can help bring even more people together. And we can create a world that is much more positive, and where people are given life rather than death. And there's a lot of us. So what does it mean when we come together?
Being involved in the film has encouraged me to be a listener. And in conversation with a person who is trans, I found myself listening because I have so much to learn. But mentioning the song Georgie Girl, none of you would remember that, but there's another Georgie deep inside waiting to come out. And I guess I was trying to suggest how I could extrapolate that in terms of all of us have something deep within ourselves that in fact is good, that we've not released for one reason or another. And I sort of wanted to put that on the table in terms of how we learn from every person, every group of persons as listeners.
Marilyn, where do we get to see the film?
Go to selmatostonewall.com. That's our website, and it has information about screenings.
And I really would recommend people get the film and, set up your own screenings. Do this in your community. Do it in your faith-based community. Do it in your schools. Let's be part of the agency here to make sure that we aren't continuing to ask, are we there yet, from Selma to Stonewall in the years to come. I want to thank Gil Caldwell tremendously and Marilyn Bennett for this excellent, important film. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you very much.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The injustice of this outraged this. And I remember we had a conversation where we said, someone's got to change this. It's terrible. And then, of course, when you say things like that, you're inevitably hit with the thing, well, wait a sec. We qualify. Back in that time, our movement was fighting just for the right to not be thrown into jail for being gay. Relationships wasn't even on the agenda. The letter said that the petition for me to stay here as the spouse of a U.S. citizen had been turned down because, quote, you have failed to establish that a bona fide marital relationship can exist between two faggots.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Serving in silence ends for U.S. transgender military personnel. Tear gas and rubber bullets shut down defiant Istanbul expressions of pride. And love wins late for a limited partnership. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the 2 weeks ending June 25th, 2016. The U.S. Defense Department will lift its ban on service by transgender personnel on July 1st. A Pentagon official told USA Today that each branch of the armed services will be directed over a one-year period to implement new policies on recruiting, housing, and uniforms for transgender troops. The announcement comes a year after Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said that he'd initiated a study into how to best integrate transgender military personnel. Not surprisingly, this week's announcement drew immediate praise from LGBT activists. Matt Thorne, executive director of the military rights group OutServe SLDN, said in a press release that lifting the ban will have given a breath of relief and overdue respect to transgender service members who have been and are currently serving our country with undeniable professionalism, the utmost respect, and illustrious courage, with the caveat to do so silently. Today we mark history once again by ending the need to serve in silence.
It's been 5 years since Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, allowing gay and lesbian personnel to serve openly. According to a June 24th story in the Navy Times, officials with that service branch are urging the thousands of sailors and Marines kicked out because of their sexual orientation to appeal their discharges to the Board of Correction of Naval Records. And what the paper called a step to restore benefits and right historical wrong, it's not yet clear if other branches of the U.S. military will follow suit.
Italy's highest court made it a little easier this week for gays and lesbians to adopt a partner's biological child. It upheld a lower court ruling allowing a so-called stepchild adoption because the family bond was well established. However, while calling the ruling a step forward, the LGBT rights group Familia Arcobaleno, Rainbow Families, said it falls short of having immediate recognition at birth of both parents in same-gender civil unions, which were open to lesbian and gay couples earlier this year. That bill passed in Parliament despite strong opposition from the country's politically powerful Roman Catholic Church, only after a provision to allow same-gender couples to adopt was dropped. Passage nevertheless ended Italy's reign as the last holdout in Western Europe to legally recognize gay and lesbian couples.
Reacting to the UK vote this week to leave the European Union, LGBT rights advocates across the continent have generally expressed concerns that the absence of Britain's strong pro-LGBT voice will take some pressure off recalcitrant EU member states to advance equality. Marriage champion Prime Minister David Cameron has already announced his resignation. The government of Iran and Russia's Vladimir Putin were joined in applauding Britain's exit from the EU by U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
One of Kenya's regional high courts has legalized anal probes to check for proof that a suspect is gay. The barbaric practice has been thoroughly discredited by medical professionals around the world as scientifically worthless. Human rights groups call anal probes a violation of international treaties against torture. Private consensual adult gay sex is illegal in the East African nation and punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Two men challenged the constitutionality of the procedure after they were forced by police to undergo the probes to determine if they'd had sex. Mombasa High Court Judge Matthew Emekule dismissed the case on June 16th, concluding that there was no other way evidence could have been obtained. According to local activist Eric Gitari, Emekule's decision included a long rant about how food is processed by the human body, that the mouth and the anus are not sexual organs, and compared sodomists to dogs. The homosexuality trial of the two men is ongoing. Their lawyer says they'll appeal this week's anal probe ruling.
Elsewhere, voters in the self-governing British Overseas Territory of Bermuda have dealt a setback to supporters of same-gender couples, rejecting by a more than 2-to-1 margin both marriage equality and civil unions for lesbian and gay couples. The June 23rd non-binding referendum asks voters to decide each question separately. Out of some 65,000 residents, about 44,000 Bermudians were registered to vote in the referendum. However, the two questions are only considered to have been answered with a minimum voter turnout of at least 50%. It's not clear in the latest reports by Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper if that threshold was reached. But Premier Michael Dunkley insisted earlier in the week that any outcome is the will of the people and will guide their elected officials accordingly.
In other news, thousands of LGBT people and their allies marched through central Seoul on June 11th in the South Korean capital's annual Pride Parade. The online news portal Asia One reported that about 2,000 police officers were deployed along the parade route to separate marchers from hundreds of fundamentalist Christians protesting the event, chanting slogans and holding signs, one reading in English that, "Homosexual is sin, return to Jesus." Undaunted, an estimated 5,000 people marched in the parade, waving rainbow flags and dancing along the route to music being blared from several sound trucks.
Some 6,000 police officers guarded an estimated 1,500 LGBT rights activists and their supporters in what was called an equality march in Kyiv on June 12th. The procession in Ukraine's capital city only went a couple of blocks, but participants blew soap bubbles along the way, played drums, and chanted, "Human rights is our pride," and "No to violence, yes to rights." There were serious safety concerns leading up to the march because right-wing, ultra-nationalist groups had once again threatened violent disruptions. A number of them broke through police lines at last year's event and threw smoke grenades and firecrackers at the participants. Two police officers were injured. There were also homophobic protesters chanting, "Death to fags," this year, but the march and rally remained peaceful. And aside from some hoarse voices, there were no injuries. 57 people were reportedly detained by police for behaving aggressively.
But it was police officers in Istanbul behaving aggressively when they broke up a disallowed pride march in the Turkish capital on June 19th. The event was specifically devoted to the T's in LGBT and was a prelude to the main march scheduled for June 26th. City officials banned both events earlier in the week, citing security concerns following the Pulse massacre in Orlando, Florida. Reuters reported that three suspected Islamic State militants were arrested in Istanbul after an anonymous tip said that they were planning to attack that trans pride march on the 19th. But Turkish police arguably did more real damage. They used water cannons, tear gas, and rubber bullets to disperse dozens of defiant trans activists and their allies who'd taken to the streets without permission to unfurl a large rainbow flag. Some 300 officers in riot gear attacked the activists, some of whom told the online BuzzFeed news site that they'd simply gathered in front of the Istanbul Pride office to read a media statement and had no plan to march anywhere. They'd already been threatened by ultranationalists and fundamentalist Islamic protesters who'd gathered nearby before the police arrived and began the assault. Organizers had said they'd expected up to 100,000 people to attend the largest LGBT pride parade in the Islamic world in Istanbul on June 26th. After 13 consecutive years of relatively peaceful marches, organizers themselves called it off this year, citing genuine security concerns.
But finally, New York has already declared the site a historic city landmark, and LGBT people and their allies can now take pride in the U.S. movement's first ever national monument. President Barack Obama made official on June 24th what we first reported several weeks ago. His announcement from the White House comes, appropriately enough, during this month's traditional U.S. Pride celebrations.
Back in 1969, as a turbulent decade was winding down, the Stonewall Inn was a popular gathering place for New York City's LGBT community. At the time, being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender was considered obscene, illegal, even a mental illness. One night, police raided the bar and started arresting folks. Raids like these were nothing new, but this time the patrons had had enough, so they stood up and spoke out. The riots became protests. The protests became a movement. The movement ultimately became an integral part of America. So this week, I'm designating the Stonewall National Monument as the newest addition to America's national park system. Stonewall will be our first national monument to tell the story of the struggle for LGBT rights. I believe our national park should reflect the full story of our country, the richness and diversity and uniquely American spirit that has always defined us, that we are stronger together, that out of many, we are one.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama.
And that's News Wrap for the 2 weeks ending June 25th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
In a late-breaking update from Istanbul, Turkish authorities aggressively cracked down on a second expression of pride on June 26th. German Green Party European MP Terry Reinke and well-known activist Volker Beck were among some 19 people detained when police dispersed a press conference with tear gas and rubber bullets. It was attempted in lieu of Istanbul's annual Pride Parade, which organizers had already canceled due to safety concerns. Sing along as Broadway serenades Orlando later in the program.
How the world can change, it can change like that, due to one little word, married. See a palace rise from a two-roomed flat, due to one little word, married. And the old despair that was often there suddenly ceases to be. For you wake one day, look around and say, my lovely boyfriend, or if I were a lesbian, my girlfriend. But I'm not, so my boyfriend,
before the world changed, the word married and an infamous insult from the U.S. government set the stage for an enduring gay love story. Here's This Way Out's Steve Pride.
In the mid-1970s, Richard Adams and his husband, Tony Sullivan, filed the first federal lawsuit seeking equal treatment for a same-sex marriage in U.S. history.
I'm Cleela Rorix, former county clerk from Boulder County, Boulder, Colorado.
And I'm Anthony Sullivan, the surviving spouse of Richard Adams.
I'm Tom Miller. I'm the producer and director of Limited Partnership, a 40-year love story of Richard Adams and Tony Sullivan, who met in the early 70s and got legally married in Boulder, Colorado in 1975. But one of the interesting things is that Tony was from Australia, and so they used that marriage license to have Tony apply for a green card.
This 40-year saga began in the Boulder County Clerk's Office.
In March of 75, I had two guys come to my office asking for a marriage license. They were both from Colorado Springs. And I spoke to our district attorney and got a legal opinion on whether our Colorado marriage code would prohibit giving them a license. At the time, it did not. It was not addressed as an issue in the Colorado marriage code that a marriage had to be between a man and a woman. So he left it up to me to make the decision. And I decided that I was going to give them a marriage license. And I subsequently went on to issue 5 more licenses, one of them being for Tony and Richard. I had never really knowingly met anyone who was gay or lesbian. I felt like it was the right thing to do. I was kind of a budding feminist, and we were fighting for our own rights. Our paths at that time didn't cross yet with the gay rights movement. The women's movement did not. So all hell broke loose in many areas of the country. I received a lot of hate mail from entire church congregations telling me I was creating a Sodom and Gomorrah. The local paper editorialized against me, telling me I was going to lower the property value of Boulder since all these gay people are going to flock to town to live. Later, Colorado went on to revise the marriage code, but they didn't negate those 6 marriage licenses. And just as Tony and Richard did, I feel that that marriage license that they have is a valid marriage license.
Tony, how did you and Richard end up in Clela's office?
We had realized that we wanted to be together. And the immigration law at the time was that gay people weren't even allowed into the country as tourists, that if you'd been naturalized, you could be stripped of your citizenship and deported, and you couldn't apply for a green card. And the injustice of this, before we really realized how it affected us, outraged us. And I remember we had a conversation where we said, someone's got to change this, it's terrible. And then, of course, when you say things like that, you're inevitably hit with the thing, wait a sec. We qualify for that, but we, same token, said, wait a sec, let's back off. And we made a decision to wait 6 months before we decide that we would take a stand. And in that 6 months, of course, the realization that we did not want to be separated, which was the main thing, sunk in deeper and deeper. And at the end of 6 months, we decided that we would take a stand. And we went to Troy Perry, who had the Metropolitan Community Church, who was performing what was known as Holy Unions. He's been left out of the history a bit, and it's wrong, because before Stonewall, he was talking about gay relationships. People need to remember that back in that time, our movement was fighting just for the right to not be thrown into jail for being gay. Relationships wasn't even on the agenda. So we went to Troy and approached him and said that we wanted to get a holy union and go to the courts on the grounds of freedom of religion, like the Native Americans did with peyote. And so we had the Holy Union, we were planning what to do, and then suddenly we read in The Advocate, the gay publication, about the marriages in Boulder, Colorado. And we thought, well, if Colorado has allowed this to go on this length of time when it's receiving high publicity, this must be for real. So in good faith, we flew to Boulder, Colorado, went to Clela's office, got issued a marriage license. We were so nervous about the law possibly changing. We took our own ministers with us to getting the license and got the actually married in the courthouse corridor outside Clela's office and took the license straight back in so that there'd be no chance of it not being received.
After the marriage, you applied for citizenship as Richard's spouse. How did the U.S. government respond?
The letter was delivered on a Saturday morning, and the post person, when I opened it, was still there. We had to sign for it. And I read it, and I thought, no, this can't be real. And so I showed it to the post person and said, does this say what I think it says? He looked at it and just gave a silent nod. So I gave it to Richard. And I suppose I was a little unkind when he'd read it. I turned around and said, it's your government. The letter said that the petition for me to stay here as the spouse of a U.S. citizen had been turned down because, quote, you have failed to establish that a bona fide a marital relationship can exist between two faggots, close quote.
Richard and Tony's battle to stay together led them to flee the U.S., and as Richard was not allowed immigration to Tony's homeland due to an antiquated law in Australia, the couple found themselves without a country, floating around Europe, eventually sneaking back home across the U.S. border with Mexico. Their complex and moving story is beautifully recounted in the documentary Limited Partnership. Find more information about the film online at limitedpartnershipmovie.com. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Shortly before he died in December of 2012, Richard Adams told Tony Sullivan that they had won in the end because they had not been separated. They finally won in legal terms earlier this year. Troy Masters is the Los Angeles reporter who broke the story. He updated This Way Out's Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones.
Anthony Sullivan, after fighting for 41 years to have what he believed all along was a valid license that was issued to him by the county clerk in Boulder, Colorado, his marriage certificate was honored by the federal government. Now, the oldest existent gay marriage in the world.
Is this more a symbolic thing, or are there any actual legal ramifications since the husband has passed on?
Well, there are legal ramifications because he is entitled to benefits, including Social Security. His citizenship, of course, was a benefit of their marriage. So he's now a permanent resident. He can apply, and I think it's 5 years to become a citizen, and that's pretty automatic. But he is entitled to all the privileges and benefits of any surviving spouse.
Have you talked to him since this happened?
Oh, yeah, many times.
And how is he doing?
He's enthusiastic. You know, initially, I think he was, like, very high about it. He didn't talk about it. The note came in March, and we're just now sort of, like, getting it out there in the public sphere. So I think it was a great relief, which then led sort of to a depression, which normally happens, to know that you've fought so hard to get something that you are now going to enjoy post-relationship because of Richard's death. So that leads to depression. And also just having the thing that you fight for being resolved, you know, I think that also leads to a little bit of it. But we worked hard to make sure he's been honored. And aside from the article, he's gotten a lot of attention. The West Hollywood City Council honored him at the opening of the Pride celebration. So the mayor's party, the first party that they throw for Pride, was about honoring Anthony, which was really wonderful. They gave him a proclamation. He was there to receive it with the first relative who's ever visited him since his 41 years. As many people might know, he was alienated from his family, and they believed him to be dead until his niece started reading the stories. And she came from Australia to visit him. So she was with him for the Pride celebration.
Do you know if he has any plans of doing anything untoward with that letter from the government denying him his marriage? Like maybe a ceremonial burning of it? Or
I think it's like it's a piece of history. I hope he doesn't burn. Now it's a treasure. Like if you had that framed side by side with the letter of apology later from USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration, that's just an amazing document.
That was reporter Troy Masters with our Wenzel Jones and Abby Dees. And finally this week, a chorus of big names sends Orlando some love from Broadway.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone.
No, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb.
There are oceans and rivers
enough to cross.
Enough to last. Enough to last till the end of time.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little love.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
No, not just for some, but for everyone.
Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are
it feels enough to grow.
There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine.
Oh, listen, Lord.
If you want to know.
If you want to know.
But for everyone, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
What the world needs now
is love,
sweet love. What the world needs now is love,
what we need.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love.
What the world needs now.
Kristen Bell, Wayne Brady, Matthew Broderick, Sarah Jessica Parker, B.D. Wong, Whoopi Goldberg, Joel Gray, Bernadette Peters, Sean Hayes, Rosie Perez, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Carole King were just some of the Broadway stars singing Burt Bacharach's What the World Needs Now is Love. Now that you've sung along, you should download it. The proceeds will go to the LGBT Center of Central Florida, which is helping the victims and survivors of the Pulse Massacre. It's available on iTunes or at broadwayrecords.com/broadway-4FOR-Orlando. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, Jessica Andrea, Steve Pride, and Abby Dees and Wenzel Jones contributed program material. Broadway for Orlando and Alan Cumming performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. Check out now playing information, pics of the crew, and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email TWORadio at AOL.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078 USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KMUN Astoria, Oregon, to B.O.B. Taree, New South Wales, WBAI, New York, New York, and more than 200 other states around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Canavo understands and acknowledges that Hannah Arendt was not primarily an environmental thinker, but he's found in Arendt's book, The Human Condition, published in 1958, key insights into humans' relationship to nature and to the built environment. In fact, he sees Arendt's work as prescient, as anticipating later critiques put forward by environmentalists. Critiques of consumerism and of unregulated development and sprawl. Canavo, an associate professor of government at Hamilton College, also believes we're in a crisis of place, a crisis brought on by an overemphasis on the creation of places and a corresponding neglect of their preservation. Peter Canavo is co-editor with Joseph Lane Jr. of the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon, to which he contributed a chapter called Hannah Arendt, Place, World, and Earthly Nature. He is also the author of The Working Landscape, Founding, Preservation, and the Politics of Place. When Peter Canavo joined me in studio, I asked him what motivated him to read Hannah Arendt with a focus on environment and place.
What motivated me to look at Arendt in this way was going back to graduate school. I read The Human Condition, and I was struck by how her description of the world that we create out of nature has a lot in it about environmental insights, our relationship to the spatial environment, the natural environment. At the same time, I also came across an essay by a colleague of mine named Kerry Whiteside, who talked about Hannah Arendt as an ecological thinker. That also really clued me in to some of these aspects of hers. Now, Whiteside's essay is more about her critique of consumerism, of consumption, of mass society. What I did was I went further and looked into her concept of place and our relationship with the spatial environment, with the earth.
Right, and by space and place, you mean not just the what you call earthly nature, you also refer to the built environment.
Exactly. The space is really more of an abstract concept involving dimension. What I'm really talking about is place. And place is fundamentally a human construct. That doesn't mean that the world doesn't exist outside of our perceptions. The world is certainly out there. There's an objective, natural, material reality. But when we conceive of it as coherent places with, you know, more or less specified boundaries, characteristics, that's really a human sort of perceptual overlay onto the world. And Arendt talks about creating a world, or what she calls the world, as opposed to earthly nature, or also calls the human artifice, which is also a human creation. Now, she emphasizes also the physical dimensions of work, of creating physical, enduring things, as well as action of our social interactions, our discourse, our words, our deeds, which give meaning to that constructed world. When I talk about place, I actually see it a little more broadly than that, in that place can also refer to unbuilt natural landscapes, terrains, locales that we've delineated as coherent places. And that's something she doesn't really directly talk about, though she kind of implies that the human artifice can include those things as well.
Well, let's jump into some of the concepts and terms that Arendt uses, and then later on we can get your sense of where you might depart from her understanding of, well, for example, three kinds of basic activities. So in her book, The Human Condition, Hannah Arendt identifies and describes labor, work, and action. So let's start with labor. What did Arendt mean by labor?
Labor is the activity through which we sustain ourselves as biological entities. It is the activity that involves us as natural beings. So labor involves food, getting food, shelter, clothing, basically maintaining our life processes, reproduction, maintaining our shelter, raising children. All of these processes are part of our biological side. And they're, in a sense, ephemeral processes, because what Arendt argues is that nature is ephemeral. It consumes its creations. It goes through cycles of birth, growth, death, decay, birth, growth, death, decay, and so on. And what labor does is it keeps us going within those cycles. But eventually, of course, we all die and things run down. So labor is kind of a cyclical thing. It's a cyclical activity. It doesn't involve creating enduring objects. It involves sustaining ourselves, surviving.
If nature consumes its creations and we are one of its creations, that does suggest that we are in a kind of antagonistic relationship to nature.
Yes, we are in a kind of antagonistic relationship to nature. Even though we biologically depend on nature, we're also seeking to transcend nature, to transcend these cycles. And so what we do is we exert force or change or disruption on nature and change it. We cut down trees. We dig minerals out of the earth. We reshape the land. We clear terrain. We build things. And we do that to create enduring objects, enduring places of habitation, artifacts. And that activity Arendt deems work. Work is the creation of enduring objects. And work, in some ways, escapes this cyclical, natural pattern, in that what we create outlives us. It has a certain, not necessarily immortality, because nothing lasts forever, but it certainly endures beyond our biological existence, or ideally it does. I mean, some things don't, but there's always this intention of creating something enduring.
So labor is about sustaining and maintaining ourselves in a biological sense. And then work is about building things that will endure. And you write that work is guided a lot, or perhaps solely, by this idea of what's useful, right? What's useful to us.
Exactly. Work is creating things that are useful. And it also involves creating things from a plan. So it's it has a means-ends relationship. And concept of work in this sense, Arendt gets from Aristotle. But the idea is that work creates things according to a given plan, and then that plan is executed and a thing is created. So that's also one of the distinguishing aspects of work.
Okay, and so then the third concept that Arendt introduces and describes in the human condition is action. So what is action, and how does it differ from labor as she defines it and work as she defines it?
Action is the activity of words and deeds that take place between people. It is basically the world of social interactions in which people initiate processes through acts of speech, discourse, political acts, and they create new beginnings. And then these processes are sort of spread out into the web of human relationships and have sort of further effects. People respond to them. People initiate their own forms of action. So action is probably the sort of most, maybe the hardest to define of these three, but it's basically the words and deeds that transpire between people, and it creates a sort of a collective social reality. We might talk about it creates culture, it creates a shared political reality, it creates common ends, shared values, discourse. So in some ways it's non-material. It's more again, it's words and deeds. It's as opposed to making things. Action is not guided by a plan of fabrication like work is. Like when I make a chair, I say I have a plan to make a chair. I have maybe a set of instructions that I use, materials, and I then achieve this goal of making a chair. Action doesn't really have a defined goal. It's not instrumental to anything like work is. It's an activity that sort of exists for itself. When I, if I make a political speech, or I mean, I might have a goal, a political goal in mind, but the speech itself is sort of its own end. It's an action that sort of exists for itself, but then it has its own consequences in the web of human relationships, and those consequences in many cases are beyond my control. So it's inevitably a collective act. When I have a conversation, say in the public square metaphorically, if I have a political conversation or go to a political meeting or really have any kind of interaction with others, the sort of consequences of that just spread beyond that particular interaction and whatever my intention was in initiating it.
Well, you mentioned political speech. So what is the relationship, as Arendt sees it, between action and politics?
Well, she sees action as the sort of the quintessential, or politics rather, is the sort of quintessential form of action. Politics is a realm of deliberation about the common good. And it's a realm in which everyone is sort of free, ideally, to initiate new discussions, new beginnings, new forms of discourse. And so what it is also a realm of freedom, because it's unconstrained by the demands of nature, the need to survive and maintain oneself. it's not constrained by the plans and instrumental processes of work. I mean, when I make a chair or bake a cake or whatever, I have to follow a certain plan. Action is a matter of freedom. It's a matter of initiating new beginnings in our shared social existence. So she sees, she equates that freedom with the world of politics, the world of political deliberation, deliberation about the common good, deliberation about the shared ends of a community, of society. And in many ways, this goes back to Aristotle's notion of politics and to the ancient Greeks.
That's Peter Canavo. He's associate professor of government at Hamilton College. We are talking about an article he wrote about Hannah Arendt and place, world, and earthly nature. He contributed that article to a volume he co-edited. It's called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism, and the Political Theory Canon. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So if action is about words and also deeds, then is action also partly about naming and assigning certain labels to the things around us?
Yes. Arendt says that without action, the world would be a heap of unrelated things. So if we created a material world, but we didn't name it, we didn't give it significance, we didn't define the things we created, we didn't talk about their relationships, establish their relationships, name them, the world wouldn't really make sense to us. I mean, it's almost, you can't even really imagine such a scenario of us creating this whole built-up world without actually saying anything about it or conceptualizing it in any way. But the point is that in order to create this human artifice, we don't just do the material work of transforming nature, but we also need to engage in action. We need to name it, define it, describe it, identify it, to create places out of it, to create identifiable things, to give these things a history, to tell stories about them, to tell stories about our relationships with them. So this human artifice that we've created is as much a product of discourse, of our social web of relations, as it is of physical work.
Give us an example of a place that we create via action, via, for example, speech.
Well, one place we could create purely, well, not entirely purely, but very much through speech, through action, is to identify a wilderness landscape. So let's take the Adirondacks, for example. That's near to where I live. The Adirondacks is a mountainous region in upstate New York, and it's also a place where in the late 19th century the state of New York created a park. So the state basically drew a line around this area, and they created a place. Now, that line doesn't exist physically. We didn't build a wall. There was an act of legislation, a political deed, created this boundary for the Adirondacks. Then that boundary was instantiated through various policies, through a constitutional amendment that deemed that much of it would remain forever wild, et cetera, et cetera. But what we did was we took an area out of the terrain of upstate New York and we drew this line and we created an incredibly important place through action, not by building something. Now, again, eventually, in the long term, even these wilderness areas that we define, there may be some physical manipulation through some management in a very extremely limited way in protected wilderness areas. There may be a few outposts for Park Service or Forest Service employees. But basically, these especially protected wilderness areas are really just delineated through action, not through physical transformation. So our whole world, whether it's wilderness or the built environment or zones of the ocean that are marked out on nautical maps is delineated through in part through action, not necessarily through physical change.
So when we create something, when we name it, when we found it, that's a word that you use a lot in your book, The Working Landscape, via action, then, especially when I think about, say, wilderness areas, then there is the urge and often the necessity to preserve it. And I wonder if you could maybe start with what Arendt says about preservation and its necessity.
Preservation is important, and it's important for Arendt, but in a much more subtle way. I mean, a lot of what she talks about is founding, creating the human artifice, using action to give meaning to it. But there's also the implicit sense that this world we create has to endure, that it's not just here created to be here for today or, you know, just a short period of time, but it has to endure, and that it has to endure because it gives us a sense not only of a permanent home on Earth that we can inhabit, but also an enduring sense of identity. She says that people can relate to, for example, the same chair and table. They can come back to it and relate to these same enduring objects and also at the same time maintain their identity. So preservation is part of what she's talking about, but it's much more beneath the surface. It's more subtle. Her more explicit emphasis is on founding. Again, action is involved. It talks about new beginnings. So is preservation a new beginning, or does it actually restrain action? And to some degree, it does restrain action, because if we preserve what we've created, then that does act as some constraint on what we can build later in terms of work, but also on the new beginnings that we can create through action. Even just naming a place constrains future actions in terms of wanting to call it something else. So one point that's important is that preservation itself, just like founding, can be included within action. Action involves deliberating about the common good, about what our community will be like, what ends we should pursue. And that can include what meanings we give to places and what we want to preserve and why we want to preserve them, why some places are meaningful to us and need to be maintained. They need to endure. So preservation exists in this rather ambiguous relationship with action. In some ways, it constrains it, but in other ways, it can be seen as part of action, just as founding is. Now, the other aspect of preservation that comes in with Arendt is the fact that she says that Earth, our earthly home, is really the quintessential aspect of the human condition. It's very fundamental to who we are. And briefly, why she says that and what I draw out in this chapter is that she is arguing that on the one hand, we are trying to define ourselves in distinction to the Earth, in distinction to nature. We're trying to transcend it through work, through action. But in another sense, having nature there as something to sort of work against or work in relation to is part of what defines us as human beings. And also, the stability of the natural world itself is implicitly, at least in what she's saying, is necessary to maintain the very sort of creations that we make through our interventions into nature, our transformations of nature. So there's a kind of ambivalent relationship with nature, but part of that ambivalent relationship is the need to actually preserve nature, preserve the earth.
I'm CS. My guest is Peter Canavo. He teaches in the Government Department at Hamilton College. He's the author of The Working Landscape, Founding, Preservation, and the Politics of Place. And he also co-edited with Joseph Lane Jr. the volume Engaging Nature, to which he contributed an article about Hannah Arendt and her view of place. And again, for those of you who are just joining us, I want to redefine the three terms we're using a lot, because these terms we're using as defined by Arendt: labor is the activity of attending to bodily needs, such as the need for food. It's concerned with life-sustaining consumption rather than creation. Work, according to Arendt in the book The Human Condition, is the activity through which human beings create enduring physical objects from pre-given plans or designs. And action is the activity of words and deeds transpiring directly between persons. Okay, so Arendt then sees the stability of earthly nature and the built environment to be very important to our continued existence. So, right, there's a strong sense of preservation, of keeping something the same or keeping it at least in a stable condition. So is it correct to see that as an environmentalist stance, right, that she thinks that there's a large part of what's out there that needs to be preserved rather than destroyed or transformed in significant ways?
Yes, her stance is environmentalist in a way that precedes the modern environmental movement, or rather it's an environmentalist stance, and it precedes by over 10 years, really, the modern environmental movement, which started around 1970, and we're talking about a work that was written in 1958. What she's concerned about is a few things. One is the increasing instrumentalization of the world. Instrumentalization is the turning of things into instruments for further purposes. And when you instrumentalize something, you inherently devalue it. You treat it as a thing to be used. And interestingly, even though she says we have to even exert violence against nature, she's concerned at the same time that our instrumentalizing activities, which to a large degree is what work is based on, instrumentalizing and using things to create new things, she's concerned that that is going rampant and that we are instrumentalizing everything and that things cease to have value. And she's simultaneously concerned about the instrumentalization of the natural world in a way that ultimately destroys any sort of dignity that nature might have, and also the instrumentalization of the human artifice, the destruction of what we've created. And what that turns into, that sort of unrestrained instrumentalization, is rampant consumption. We make and remake and destroy, and we basically consume all that's around us. And what rampant consumption then sort of degenerates into is actually a kind of labor, where everything becomes consumed in a kind of
A cycle,
and a kind of perversion of the life process, where, you know, and she doesn't say this explicitly, but wants become needs. I mean, we see that today in our society, where we don't just want to have as big a house or as big a car as possible, but we need to. And so our needs become out of bound. They become boundless, and we basically, everything becomes consumed in this kind of cancerous sort of or monstrous version of the life process. So things get instrumentalized as work, and everything ultimately gets instrumentalized, and then that degenerates into a kind of mass consumption, which then becomes a kind of version of labor, which she sees labor as a kind of lowly activity. It's not what represents the sort of highest aspects of human existence. And, you know, one might take issue with that. I think one should. But her point, though, is that we lose these other forms of activity, of work and action, that do create an enduring world. And when work and then labor sort of run rampant, we basically consume the world around us. And you can see that in the whole culture of mass consumption. And that whole critique of consumption, which was starting to maybe get going in the 50s, really took hold later in the 60s and early 70s, where you suddenly had this full-bore explosion of environmental consciousness. And she's really anticipating that.
Does Hannah Arendt, does she see this consumption and this instrumentalism, this extreme instrumentalism, arising from the relationship that humans have come to have with their environment, both the natural environment and the built environment?
Yes, she talks about a kind of alienation from the world around us. There are various aspects of that, one of which is the kind of distance we develop from the world through things like quantification. There's also the alienation of seeing everything as an instrument, seeing everything as an object of consumption. So what basically she's talking about are processes that she associates with modernity that tend to detach us from a sense of the world being a home for us, and turning the world into an object of consumption, turning it into something we just quantify and measure and don't appreciate in a qualitative way. These are aspects of alienation. One thing she contrasts this with, not in The Human Condition, but in a collection of works called Between Past and Future, is the notion of cultivation and care, which are activities that have a more nurturing quality, and they don't destroy what's around us. They don't subject it to quantification, but they sort of work with nature, work with natural processes to cultivate things out of nature that we can use and that can help us to flourish. One might think of certain agriculture. In fact, the root of agriculture in terms of cultivation, certain types of farming, which work with rather than try to overwhelm natural processes, as falling under this notion of care and cultivation.
Peter Canavo, Associate Professor of Government at Hamilton College. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Peter about Hannah Arendt and also his own understandings of founding and preservation and the politics of place. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Canavo teaches in the Department of Government at Hamilton College, where he directs its environmental studies program. He's working on a book about the connections between environmentalism and civic republicanism in the U.S. He's the author of The Working Landscape, which examines the conflict between development and preservation as a major factor behind what he calls our contemporary crisis of place. And he wrote an article about Hannah Arendt and the politics and the philosophy of place in a volume that he co-edited. It's called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. It's published by the MIT Press. We have links to Peter and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. One thing you're very interested in is how places are created, how they are named, what process goes into the action, the words and deeds that create many places. And you point out, and I think you point out that Hannah Arendt points out, that this delineation of places doesn't always take place by consensus, right? That the deliberation isn't always smooth and easy.
deliberation is not always smooth and easy. In fact, one question might be, has it ever been smooth and easy, and has it ever been truly democratic? I mean, in some ways, we're talking about an ideal that one should aspire to and try to approximate, not an ideal that's just utopian fantasy. And the better we are at it, the better off we are, and the better we are at creating places. Places usually don't arise through deliberation, through democratic deliberation. I mean, think of how places are created. They're often created through conquest, through colonization, through war, through government fiat, through developers, real estate interests, ethnic cleansing. I mean, I'm talking about all different ways that we create places in anti-democratic or non-democratic or even brutal ways. Places are often created despotically, whether by government or armies or corporations or private property owners, et cetera, et cetera. So that I see as a problem, because if one has to live in a place that has been forcibly created by others, or one is kicked out of a place because it's being forcibly transformed by others, that's problematic in the sense that that place is no longer your home. It's an alienating condition. It's, if we value democracy and self-determination, obviously that is in conflict with it. And it's something we surprisingly tolerate. When a developer decides to transform hundreds of acres into some sort of mega project, yeah, there's resistance from, the community, and they have to go through environmental impact statements and hearings. But it's something that even in a ostensibly democratic society, we regard as basically something legitimate. This person is a private property owner. They have the right to do what they want with their property, even though they're not just someone with a house and a little lot, but someone who's a huge developer or controls, hundreds or thousands of acres. So in many cases, places are imposed on us. They're founded forcibly, despotically.
Well, even if democratic deliberation went into the creation of places, one could imagine that people have different opinions, right? Different opinions about what should be delineated, where it should be created. There could be a lack of consensus among the participants in that process.
Yeah, I mean, consensus is obviously would be great. I think the key is, as with any political process, is to have a democratic process that is open to ongoing contestation and deliberation, even if a majority might rule at a given point and affect a change in the landscape. So let's say a community like, for example, in the Dudley Street neighborhood in Boston, where they've had a whole sort of community redevelopment project, and the community there formed an organization, a nonprofit, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, which undertook a redevelopment of the area. Now, that process involved a lot of public meetings. They brought in as many members of the community as possible to discuss their plans for the area, which included new housing, a park, cleaning up empty trash-strewn lots, exercising eminent domain over properties over abandoned properties to redevelop them into housing. So that was a collective community-based act of founding and transformation, but it happened through an open process, through public meetings and bringing people from the community in to deliberate on this whole project. Now, there are obviously going to be people who disagree with that, and I think the key is to have a process that's open so that those people who may be unhappy with the decision today can at least come back and raise other proposals or challenge it or help to reevaluate it later on. You're obviously not going to get 100% consensus on how to either found or preserve a place because people have very different conceptions of it. And so what's important is that you have an open process. And what's also important is that you come to some provisional agreement on how to manage that place. Because if we wait for consensus, then nothing's going to happen. At the same time, we also want as open and deliberative a process as possible.
Peter Cannavo, C-A-N-N-A-V-O, Associate Professor of Government at Hamilton College. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You asked the question at the end of the essay you wrote for that volume, what would an Arendtian green politics look like? So how important would open, democratic, deliberative conversations and deliberations be to that kind of politics, do you think?
Well, I think it would actually be very important. I see this kind of politics as follows. And again, I'm not trying to spell out some rigid blueprint because that in some ways defeats the idea of a open democratic process where you tell people what they're supposed to do before they even set out to do it. Not that anyone would necessarily listen to me anyway. But but the idea is to institute deliberation at a very local level, neighborhoods within cities, small towns, to have as much local deliberation as possible about issues like neighborhood redevelopment, green spaces, even strategies for adapting to or being resilient in the face of climate change. And then working up from that, what I would envision is regional governments. And this experiment in regionalism has been done in a few places, most notably in Portland, Oregon, where you take a metropolitan area, or perhaps if you're in rural or wilderness areas, a watershed, and you bring these local communities together into some kind of regional deliberation about the overall environmental, social, infrastructural quality of their region. And this is, I think, where we could see this kind of democratic, deliberative politics of place sort of really being best instantiated.
Well, why regional? I mean, in some ways you're talking about localities, and then you're also talking about municipalities. Regional suggests larger, at times, a larger place than a municipality. So why the focus on the region?
The focus on the region, even from a purely democratic sense, is that smaller is not necessarily more democratic, and bigger is not necessarily less democratic. A lot of the issues we face today in terms of the places we inhabit, their character, their durability, and these issues include environmental issues, issues of distributional equity, quality of schools, of housing. A lot of those issues extend beyond the capacity of a city, let alone a neighborhood or a small town or a small jurisdiction, to really address. What often happens is now you have, for example, a metropolitan area like, take any major city. The city is fragmented, is fragmented into a whole bunch of small municipalities, special districts, school districts, water districts, local suburban governments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you get is a situation where you have a number of small communities, many of whom have very little control over the economic forces, the environmental forces, the social forces that are affecting them, because they're really too small to control these things. Then you get a few or relatively few communities which have a lot of power and wealth and are able to accumulate resources for themselves in terms of money and nice amenities, good schools, good housing, and then basically foist undesirable things like hazardous waste sites or sewage treatment plants or bus transfer stations, et cetera, on less powerful communities or inner cities within these metropolitan areas. And so you get all sorts of inequities, often along class and racial lines. What metropolitan or regional government does is it enables localities to coordinate more, to control these forces that are seemingly beyond their control, these forces that take place on this regional scale. So in a sense, the regional approach combined with local participation on legitimately local issues is in a sense more democratic than what we have now. Of course, there are lots of political obstacles to this, because one of the reasons our metropolitan areas are fragmented is because of the power of certain communities to maintain their independence and resist sharing resources with other communities that are, you know, less fortunate and less politically powerful. But again, regionalism, because it enabled small communities to have a sort of collective voice in controlling social, environmental, and economic processes, changes, and forces, is more democratic than the kind of municipal fragmentation we have now. So the recipe I'm seeing is a combination of local and regional democracy.
And I want to say that Peter Canavo, my guest, he makes his argument, he makes the case for regional democratic governance in his book, The Working Landscape, Founding Preservation and the Politics of Place. And I want to stick with that book for a moment, because you argue in that tome that in the U.S. there's been an overemphasis on founding, that is, creating of places, to the exclusion of preservation of places. How so?
Well, we have an overemphasis on founding in that we basically have taken our landscape and regarded it as one giant set of commodities. And the whole notion of turning place into real estate, into something that can be bought and sold, developed and redeveloped in order to suit the needs of the market, is in a sense to go against any real preservationist impulse. Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, described capitalism as engaged in a process of creative destruction. And what's happened is that we, to also go back to Arendt, we've kind of taken the transformation, commodification, development of our landscape to an extreme where we're basically consuming it, sort of eating it up and then discarding it as waste. You can see this in our landscape of suburban sprawl, which may be the sort of quintessential landscape of the second half of the 20th century, in which you see a kind of cycle of building and abandonment. For much of the second half of the 20th century, cities were on the decline. They were abandoned by white flight, by disinvestment. Of course, there were still people living there who were sort of bore the brunt of a lot of this. So then as people moved out to the suburbs, and the suburbanization actually started in the late 19th century, but really picked up after World War II. So as people then moved to first to inner suburbs and then gradually to outer suburbs, the inner suburbs themselves started to decay, to become abandoned, to fall apart, to suffer disinvestment. Then you had people moving out to the outer suburbs, creating subdivisions, strip malls. Then you see now a lot of malls themselves have been abandoned. And so there's this cycle of rampant development without regard for history, for ecology, for human health, for quality of life. So rampant development followed by decay and dilapidation, and then just development further afield.
Could one generalize to say that one can make more money by creating or building something new rather than by preserving something that's already there?
Yeah, the market, the way the market and regulations and everything are all structured, zoning laws, et cetera, they've really encouraged this. In fact, a lot of this sprawl is not just the product of the market, but of longstanding government policies through much of the 20th century that actively promoted suburbanization and promoted disinvestment from cities. So in many ways, it's easier and more profitable to just keep building further and further out. Of course, that ultimately runs up into environmental limits in terms of the use of energy, of fuel, the burden of commuting, et cetera, et cetera. The other side of this is that we've preserved a fair amount of land as wilderness, and I think that's great. But we've tended to do, and this is, I'm not the first person to point this out, other people like Michael Pollan and Bill Cronin have also made this point before I did, that we take part of our landscape and we sanctify it and preserve it, and that's wilderness or parks, which are, you know, used much more than wilderness, but are still protected. And then the rest we basically throw to the into the jaws of the market. So, you know, we have this kind of split mentality of, you know, pieces that are preserved, but then the majority is really commodified. Now, I'm caricaturing it to some degree, but that's sort of the, in many ways, the general pattern.
Peter, you note in your book, The Working Landscape, that many politically progressive academics tend to disparage notions of preservation as static and reactionary. Really?
Yeah, I think that there is a tendency among academics to value mobility, hybridity, flux, change. That notions of preservation have a kind of taint of conservatism, of reaction. There's a concern that place means parochialism, exclusion. And certainly those are real concerns in terms of pathologies of place and preservation. I mean, these values can be taken to extremes or into sort of perverse directions. But I also think we really lose something when we move away too much from stability, from preservation, because those values themselves actually, though in some sense conservative, are also quite radical today. Our society and its sort of capitalist ethos is very much built on constant change, on creative destruction, on transformation, and subjecting people to these sort of unrelenting forces of the market and the whole notion, well, that's progress, you can't do anything about it. And the notion of stability and preservation in the face of that is actually, I think, quite radical. And this is in some ways why environmentalism, which in some ways is a deeply conservative movement, is also extremely radical in the context of capitalism. It really opposes that sort of ruthless transformative aspect.
Peter Canavo, he teaches in the government department at Hamilton College. He's author of The Working Landscape, Founding Preservation and the Politics of Place. He's co-editor with Joseph Lane Jr. of the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. You can read an article he wrote therein about Hannah Arendt, Place, World, and Earthly Nature. Thanks so much, Peter, for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.